We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, and we have a couple of items on the agenda. Pretty sure everybody's not here for our adoption of committee rules, but that is what we'll be doing first. And then we'll go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 1574. So first, we'll open up an organizational meeting for purposes of the adoption of committee rules. Senator Olson.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 02-02-2016.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2-2-16. Is there any discussion? Members of the committee, these are the rules that you've probably seen in other committees, standard across the board. So any questions, any discussion, are there any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted, and we can now close the organizational meeting, and we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1574, and I am going to pass the gavel. I'll meet Senator Beyer at the dais, and we're going to kick it off here. So,
since I have the gavel, guess what we're going to do right now?
This is bipartisanship, man.
We're heading to Magoo's, folks.
No throwing of gavels.
Before you get started, as the new gavel holder of the committee, I would like to state that prior to this legislative meeting, I had submitted a letter, a request to the chair, to President Courtney, to the Secretary of the Senate, to the Majority Leader and the Minority Leader, that I would ask that witnesses testify under oath. So I will not make two senators testify under oath, but the next panel that come up will be asked to be sworn to tell the truth. If you decide that you don't want to, you don't have to. There's some protocol to this. Do you have anything that was written down? We don't? Okay. My other committee had some protocols. Okay, you have the rights. You do not have to swear an oath. You can choose to have an attorney present if you'd like. I assume there's a couple attorneys in there. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this is immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. Thank you very much. Senator Beyer, Senator Edwards, you have the floor.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene. And we bring to you today Senate Bill 1574, the Healthy Climate Act of 2016. I won't go through the details of the bill as we did that a couple of weeks ago when we went through the legislative concept. After Senator Beyer and I kick things off here, we will have an opportunity with Legislative Council to go through the amendment that is before the committee. But I just wanted to say a few words about why we're taking this up and why this session. As I stated last time our committee was together, global climate change is a real issue, and some of us believe that we are already behind in addressing it, not only on a global level, but certainly in an international level, but certainly on a national and a state level as well. The United States is responsible for more than double the per capita emissions as China. A lot of times people think of China being the largest emitter. But the United States, on a per capita basis, has more than double those emissions. And so it really is incumbent upon us as a world superpower to address it. In 2009, I believe it was 2009, there was a proposal working its way through the legislature to institute a cap-and-trade program on a state basis. And privately, I was not too enthused about that proposal in 2009. and did not get behind supporting it because I really felt like it was an issue that had momentum, and it was an issue that would certainly would be taken up by the federal government, by our U.S. Congress. Well, fast forward to 2016, and the issue has not been taken up by Congress, and I don't see in the foreseeable future that changing. So some of us feel important feel that it's important that we do our part at the state level. We believe that in joining with other states' actions, such as California and the province of British Columbia, the state of Washington, and things that they're contemplating, that in fact we can achieve emissions that are significant, not only in their greenhouse gas reduction numbers, but are also politically significant, both in North America and internationally, as that region does represent the world's fifth largest economy. I know that there's been a lot said about the timing of this legislation, and I just want to walk through the reason I believe it's important that we take it up now. This bill starts a 2.5-year planning process that would leave the rules for review by the 2019 legislative session. So we'd have two legislative sessions between now and when the program would go into effect, two long legislative sessions, so 2017 and 2019. That would allow for a 2020 implementation. We already know that we are not going to meet our 2020 greenhouse gas reduction goals. Every year that we go beyond that, it becomes more and more difficult for us. You know, the slope gets steeper. If you really believe and you really want to be serious about meeting the goals, then that becomes a steeper and steeper hill to climb. It is not my wish that this becomes such a divisive issue, but you know, at the end of the day, not everybody agrees that we should be taking the issue up at all, whether in a short session or in a long session. And I'm not convinced that taking this up in a long session would reduce the acrimony over the issue and would necessarily produce a different outcome. So if that's to be the case, then it seems to me that we ought to give the agencies and the stakeholders involved plenty of planning time. And if we put it off until 2017, that shortens the window or delays the implementation, one of those two effects. So I think it's appropriate that we take it up in the 2016 legislative session. I, for one, believe want to be on the right side of history in this issue. I know not everybody feels like it's an issue that the state should take up. I feel very, very strongly that it is an issue that we should be taking up. I don't wish it to be a particularly partisan issue. I have made efforts and attempts to craft the bill in a way that will, while making real greenhouse gas reduction, make very real greenhouse gas reductions while setting up a program that could finance a lot of really necessary infrastructure for adaptation and resilience efforts. A lot of those infrastructure investments would be felt in rural Oregon as well as in urban Oregon. I'll leave it with that. We have a couple of more hours to talk about this, so I'll just wrap it up there and turn it over to my co-chief sponsor, Senator Beyer.
Thanks, Senator. For the record, Mr. Chair, the Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lane and Linn counties. I want to applaud the detailed work that Senator Edwards has done on this. I think he's done a very excellent job of trying to address the various concerns of various parties and industries. It's not intended to be a job-killing bill, and I don't believe it is, but it does address a very serious problem. In fact, from my, I guess, 15 years now of working around the energy field and from that perspective, been able to talk with across nationally with many people who are experts in this area, and I want to be clear, I am not a scientist, but I do know that most all scientists in the world suggests that we are seeing the effects on climate and on the world from greenhouse gas emissions. I personally believe that it is probably the most serious problem facing mankind today and needs to be addressed. And probably, you know, while we're seeing it, the real impact will not be on our generation, but it will be on our children and our grandchildren's generation. And we're really talking about their ability to survive in the world ahead. And to some degree, I approach this from a traditional business perspective of risk management. And my comment to that would be, you know, from a business perspective, even if you think you're wrong, if you can do things prudently that reduce the risk in case you're, you're right, or if you disagree with this, why wouldn't you take prudent steps to reduce the risk? Some will say that this is something new and you know, that's not been tried before, and that's not exactly true. In terms of using a market-based system, cap and trade, which, by the way, the cap and trade idea comes from the Heritage Foundation, which is about as conservative an organization as you can get. They suggested at first that we needed to address climate and environmental problems using market-based approaches, which this is. The first attempt to do this was really with acid rain across the nation, but predominantly in the Northeast, and there's a cap and trade program for NOx and SOx emissions. And when that one was first put in place by the federal government, everybody thought that that was a terrible thing that was going to destroy the economy. And a couple decades later, that's not the case, and it worked. It really did have an impact. So these things are not new. And we're not the first to talk about this. I mean, we've been talking about this globally for a long time. This particular program, as y'all know, started in California recently here. We also have seven northeastern states that in part have a program like this called RETC states. And we have five Canadian provinces that have now joined. I was reminded last session, I had the minister, let me think, Ontario, was energy minister from Ontario in my office, and he was lamenting them going into the last recession. They thought Quebec was nuts because they were proceeding with their carbon tax and these kinds of programs, and they were fearful that their economy would be decimated. And his comment to me was, you know, when I watched that going on, he said, we didn't, and our economy went down, and Quebec kept growing. And that has been the case with this approach in California. It's been approached other places. Is while many people forecast that the economies would collapse, in fact, they have grown. There's been some disruption in the marketplace, but overall job growth has went up. Their state GDP has gone up. It hasn't been a negative effect on this. I think that this is an approach we need to look at. We need to address the issues. If you look at kind of the things we've seen last year, the drought that was out there, the governments, I use that term collectively, not so much the state as the federal government, spent $1 billion fighting forest fire from the things that are happening in the forest. We can't afford that. We can't afford the droughts we've had in the past. I suspect those are likely to continue. That's the forecast of the scientists. I will close in saying that I obviously think this is very important. A few minutes ago, I sent you all a bit electronically, because I couldn't get it printed, a copy out of the recent edition of the National Geographic that talks about what's happening in the Arctic and the climate impacts of that. I would encourage you to take a look at that. A couple issues ago, National Geographic had just a full issue on climate change. It's a very independent magazine, science-based magazine that I think provides good data. It's worth your time to take a look at that. With that, Mr. Chair, I would close and thank you for the opportunity to kick this off.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Basically, I mean, it comes as no surprise to you gentlemen that I have a fundamentally different a perspective of this bill, and I think they will certainly be visiting those different perspectives, as we should, over the next few days. And I realize that the preamble to this bill is not technically a part of the proposed legislation. Nevertheless, in my opinion, it contains preposterous number of false, misleading, unsupportable, and unproven statements. Each whereas is actually nothing more than a hypothesis. And strangely, the null hypothesis is missing in each one of them. Each is stated as a declaration of unsupportable and often nebulous fact. So, and I mean, not the facts that are, there's the facts that are stated as declarative statements are not universally accepted. They are not, they're open to debate. They're a hypothesis, again. So I would respectfully ask that the bill be amended to simply remove that preamble. I believe it would, although, again, it's not technically a part of the text, I think that it's, it has no part on the, it has no place in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
May I respond and bring forth one more issue?
Sure, certainly.
I will, certainly, Senator Whitsitt, I will consider that. In fact, I'll make you a deal right here. If you'll vote for the bill, it's out.
Your cohort already blew that by me.
So, but I, so there are a number of decision points with this bill, and I forgot to bring one of them up, and it can't be avoided. We talked last in my effort to kind of lower the temperature, to try and lower the temperature on not only the climate but the feelings around this bill. I made the decision to push transportation fuels back, you know, to delay bringing transportation fuels into the bill until after realization of the goals of the Clean Fuels Program, which would bring transportation fuels and not until 2025. And we didn't spend much time on the analysis of what that means for the bill, but the legislature has some decisions about to make around, and this body has decisions to make around that, whether or not to, in fact, do that. And it should be noted that that is, you know, that decision to push back transportation fuels from coming into the program also pushes back the money that is generated from the sales of those allowances, which is $300 to $400 million annually, which, I mean, you know, if you want to talk about transportation funding, that's larger than the proposal that came out a couple weeks ago around transportation funding. And that has to be a part of this discussion as well. $300 to $400 million annually over 5 years. I mean, we're looking at upwards of $2 billion. Now, of course, that wouldn't start to come in until, you know, if the program went live in 2020 and transportation fuels were included right away, and that money doesn't come in until later in 2020 or 2021. I mean, that certainly does not meet our short-term transportation needs in the state. I mean, we need a transportation package, and I feel strongly about that. But that needs to be a part of the discussion as well about what that means and the dynamics of the interplays between the sectors if you push transportation fuels back. So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dembrough, Senator Brzezinski.
Fine.
Questions?
Thank
I have some,
much.
If you don't mind.
Thank you.
I have some questions for you.
Please.
Yep. As the authors of the bill, and I would probably direct this to you, Senator Edwards, and seeing the amendments, one of the things that you put in there was that the offsets should be limited to the state of Oregon. California has extreme difficulty buying offsets in their state. How do you anticipate that we could meet offsets only from Oregon?
So, Mr. Chair, a couple of things. Some of the advocates so there are different feelings about offsets, and this is another one of those discussions we need to have. I've been very adamant from the beginning that if there are not offsets in the program, there will be no bill. And I've been really clear with folks about that. But at the same time, there are very strong and very legitimate feelings about not essentially somebody that has emissions, not allowing them to just, you know, continue emissions by investing in an offset elsewhere, you know, maybe even on the other side of the state, and it doesn't reduce emissions locally. And so we're trying to find that balance between what's an appropriate amount of emissions and an appropriate amount of offsets allowed and where those offsets ought to be allowed. There's the added economic benefit of if the offsets are created, that's investment back into the state of Oregon if they're created here in the state of Oregon. So that would be one of the reasons that we decided to go with that sort of language in the amendment. And there are a few other things in the amendments, and we're going to be talking about those in a minute once I get up there and wrestle that gavel out of your hand.
That's going to be a hard fight. Secondly, as Senator Beyer had talked about, California has a cap and trade, and do you know how that's working?
Well, we had a presentation on that September, and we've had a lot of good feedback about what's happening with job growth, industry that has said that, you know, previously said that the sky would fall, and it hasn't. And they are, in fact, taking real action to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, which I'm thankful for. I mean, they're a lot bigger state than us, and they're, you know, they've done a lot of pioneering work on this, and you know, they have resources that we don't have in the state of Oregon.
I'm going to digress a little bit. Do you know what our carbon footprint is in the world, as predicated by House Bill 3470 last year?
Mr. Chair, I know that on a percentage wise, it's really small. And I also know that if all political entities around the world said we don't have an obligation because our footprint is so small, we would have, in fact, the situation that we have now with lots of inaction and delayed action. And it's just getting worse. And at some point, I believe it's time that we all kind of step up and make an effort to leave this place better than we found it.
If I may jump in on that, I mean, I don't have the number exactly, but without a doubt, the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases in the world are the United States, the largest, and China, the second largest. China has enacted a cap-and-trade program, and I'm going to be confused if it's 5 or 7 of their provinces or states, like us, have for a couple of years. They've been running that, and they just announced before the new year that, and I believe it's 2017, might be 2019, that they will move that countrywide into a cap-and-trade program to achieve their goals of emissions. They obviously have a pretty serious problem with anybody who's been around China. But, I mean, that's the kind of indication that others are getting serious about that. And certainly the accords that were reached in Paris just recently suggest that the world as a whole has recognized that this is something we need to address.
A nice segue. Thank you very much. Because I will, for the record, it's 0.4% of the world's carbon dioxide output is from the state of Oregon. Now, that you mentioned the Paris protocols that were put forth, Oregon, the United States of America intends to go from 6 billion back to about 4.3 billion metric tons. China intends to go from 10 billion metric tons to 15 billion metric tons. See, I don't look at the per capita, because what you're talking about is how much money each of us makes and how much we put out. I look at what we actually put out, because that's what counts. It's not the dollars floating in the air. It's the actual carbon dioxide that goes into the air. And when we sit at the Paris Accord and agree to allow China to go to 5 billion metric tons more than they're doing now, and we talk about Oregon, in 2012, Oregon put out 60.9 million metric tons. 60.9 as compared to the 5 billion that China will put out. So my question then is, I don't see any dollars put in here. I don't see any prices. I have indication in your counties, in Lane County, you have 7 companies that are high, that put out a lot of carbon dioxide. Is the cost to those companies and to the jobs that will be affected by those companies worth the small percentage reduction that we will move forward with? And can you quantify what the reduction will be?
Senator, I understand what you're saying. And I think with that approach, the approach would suggest we should never do anything and just let the world go as it has. And if our grandchildren can't, you know, live on this globe, then that's their problem. That's kind of been the view of our generation. We have been a taker's generation, while our parents was the greatest generation and the builders of the country. As we approach our age, I think it's time that we put back a little bit and make the world work. It would be far better. I hear your argument, and I would guess it's more of a political argument. It would be far better if the United States Congress hit the issue head on and made it that way. That would be far better. But the lesson that we have learned politically over the last couple of decades is the only way you can get the Congress to act is if a bunch of states start acting first, in the sense of the states being the laboratories of democracy. We know from experience that that tends to cause Congress to act at some point. It's unfortunate that that's the way the system works, but it's reality.
Well, I can. Yes, go ahead. Yeah. Thank you.
So this is very painful for me because I really want to jump in and be part of this discussion.
But you're here. Go.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that, you know, we will perhaps be, this will go to a work session and we'll have a chance then to debate this. You know, I think we have a lot of people here who have a lot of testimony to give.
Fine.
I wish we could do that.
But I'd like to make this point, and the point that concerns me the most is there's no dollars attached to this. How much does it cost? House Bill 3470 said $250 million if that bill passed at $12 a ton. The Oregon Global Warming Commission recommended $60 a metric ton. That would be $1.25 billion that we would take out of Oregon's economy and move it back around again and play with it and dance with it and sing with it and give it to other people. But still that $1.25 billion will move someplace. It will cost higher rates for everything, higher electricity, higher gas, higher everything. And I know you've put it off. I appreciate that. And I was flabbergasted when you said it would cost $300 to $400 million annually just for fuel. So the question is, why don't you put a number on it so the people can see transparently what this is going to cost us to reduce our carbon output by perhaps a minuscule amount? Because you haven't defined the amount that will be lost either. Thank you.
In response, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to put a number on it because that goes back into the Oregon economy. Transportation fuels, allowances sold there stay in transportation. Allowances sold in the utility sector go back to ratepayers, and industrial allowances go into greenhouse gas emissions reductions investments here in the state of Oregon. And resiliency and adaptation efforts. We need to do that as part of this public process, and we need to make sure that it's factual information. I would contend that $60 is a number. That's a number that's out there, but that's not the market price for allowances now. They're around $13. And the analysis that was put out earlier today had a bunch of entities that aren't included. You know, in this, a lot of biomass emissions that have been deemed in this state to be carbon neutral were included in that analysis, and it also didn't take into account accommodations that we have directed in the bill. And if those accommodations need to be more specific, we can make them more specific. But for accommodations for leakage, you know, Ash Grove Cement. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that. Companies like the cement company, they are energy intensive, and they're trade sensitive, and are trade exposed. And industries like that are probably going to get accommodations and not be affected in that way. So I just think I agree, but we need to be fair in how we apply the number and what companies we apply them to. And that needs to be a part of the public discussion. I agree.
Well, the other thing that needs to be the part of the discussion is wealth redistribution, taking from one sector and passing it to another sector. But that's for later. Senator Denborough is correct. We have a lot of people that want to testify. So thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And the next panel, please.
I'll go back to the rules.
Okay.
Maureen McGee, please. Oh, I was going to knock the gavel, we'd have to go home.
I don't think it works quite that way.
It's not that easy, huh?
That would be operator error.
Without a doubt.
Okay. Dr. Marine, can you walk us through the amendments, or the amendment and the different pieces of it before we get into public testimony?
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I will do my best. For the record, my name is Maureen McGee. I am a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel. We are going to be walking through the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1574. Now, this amendment has a number of different pieces to it, and so I think probably the easiest way to walk through it for folks' understanding is to approach those pieces by subject matter. And I will not necessarily be pointing to all of the specific places in the amendment where the subject comes up, but of course I'm very happy to point that out if anyone has questions. So in no particular order, one of the first pieces, the first piece of the amendment that I will talk to is adjustments to the language establishing the cap requirement for the carbon pollution market. This adjustment can be seen on page 2 of the amendment, lines 19 through 30. And what this does is modify the language to show that the cap and the schedule for decreasing the cap over time reflect the greenhouse gas emissions from covered entities as a proportionate share of statewide greenhouse gas emissions as defined in Section 4 of this 2016 Act. So, as you may recall, statewide greenhouse gas emissions is a defined term in the bill that is used for the new greenhouse gas emissions goals and limits that are in Section 4, and it refers to the total amount of emissions from all emitters within the state. And so what this language does is make clear that the cap that covered entities within the carbon pollution market is only reflective of the proportionate share of greenhouse gas emissions that are attributable to the covered entities and not something else.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Ms. McGee,
yes.
Is there a reason why you skipped over the change on after line 15 on page 5, which adds the union agreements into it?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I just haven't gotten there yet. I plan to speak through every aspect of the amendment, but because the changes based on subject matter required tweaks throughout the bill,
okay, I'm sorry.
I thought it would be easier for a discussion if we did it topic by topic.
It was easier for me to go page 1 to page 2, but you're fine. Thank you.
I understand. I apologize for that. So again, getting back to the changes to the cap, the other adjustment was some changes in the language to make clear that when the DEQ is establishing its annual allowance budget for each year, and again, the allowance budget is the number of allowances that will be distributed into the marketplace each year, that they're taking into account the effect of offsets in relation to what the cap is. There are also changes to the provisions related to offsets, and the bulk of those changes can be found on page 3 of the amendment, lines 7 through 30, and going on to page 4 a little bit. These changes to the offset provisions make clear that offset projects must be located in this state. And I will mention that the offset provisions retain provisions in the original bill that require that greenhouse gas emission reductions or removals attributable to the offsets are in addition to greenhouse gas emissions reductions or removals otherwise required by law would not otherwise have occurred if the emissions reduction or removal activity had not been implemented, and that those emission reductions, like all other greenhouse gas emission reductions under the bill, are required to be real, permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, and enforceable. The other change here, and you'll find this change again on page 3, and it's in lines 21 through 24, is that the department or the Environmental Quality Commission will adopt standards to ensure that offset credits may be used to account for no more than 50% of the greenhouse gas emission reductions required of a covered entity during a compliance period. This language replaces language in the original bill that required that 8% of the number of compliance instruments used by an, or that no more than 8% of the number of compliance instruments in a compliance period submitted by a covered entity be attributable to offset credits. And the one thing that I want to make clear here is that those two percentages are tagged to different concepts. So it's kind of, it's two different ways at getting at a similar, it's two different ways of getting at the same concept. It's phrased differently. So the 8% was tagged to 8% of the overall amount of emissions that are allowed, and the 50% is tagged to the amount of emissions that a covered entity will be required to have reduced between one compliance period and the next. And again, the amendment retains the requirement that in adopting the offset rules, the commission will look at offset programs that have been established in other jurisdictions. There are also changes in the bill to language referring to consignment of allowances to utilities. And what this language does is just add a little bit more substance. It doesn't change at all how the consignment works, but it adds a little bit more substantive language to clarify that the allowances that are distributed to free for utilities are not allowances that can be used by the utilities as part of their compliance obligation, but that this free distribution is instead an accounting mechanism to allow for the utilities to consign the allowances back to auction, have them sold there, and then for the utilities to be able to have the proceeds distributed directly to them to use for rate relief. And then we get to the changes referring to labor standards that Vice Chair Olson mentioned. So the changes specific to labor standards, these have to do with the use of proceeds from sales of allowances. And the... let me see if I can find them here, just a moment. The main substance of these begins on page 4 of the amendment, lines 22 through 30, going on to the next page, and you'll see them again in page 7. Of the amendment, and also some changes to definitions. So what these changes do is for construction projects that are funded in whole or in part by monies that are distributed either out of the new climate investments account within the highway fund or distributed through the climate investments grant program. If it is a construction project, there will be certain labor standards that will apply to it. They'll require that the primary contractor participating in the construction project has to participate in an apprentice program, must not be a contractor that has been listed as ineligible to receive a public works contract, demonstrate a history of compliance with other certain labor standards. And then there is also a new statement in the bill that if the construction project is funded in whole or in part by monies from either the climate investments account in the highway fund or the grant program, the agencies that are administering those funds may, on a project-by-project basis, require the use of a high road agreement or a project labor agreement if the use of either type of agreement would advance the public interest or be consistent with law. High road agreement was already defined in the base bill. Project labor agreement is a new defined term in the amendments.
Mr. Chair, a question?
Yeah.
Maureen, in those labor agreement changes or labor law changes, do those changes serve to require that prevailing wage be paid on construction projects that are funded with this money?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, that was a good question. No. Prevailing wage law would apply to monies distributed out of these funds in the same way that it would apply to any other money distributed by the state. There's nothing in this bill that actually changes the way that prevailing wage law applies. So if there is money distributed out of either of these funds that otherwise would have been subject to prevailing wage law because it would be considered a public works, it would still be considered a public works here. These changes to the bill regarding these labor standards don't affect prevailing wage.
Thank you.
And then the final major topic that is addressed in the amendments is restructuring of how the advisory groups are put together for purposes of advising the agencies that are going to be distributing funds. So there is a new provision. It is sections 15A and 15B of the bill. Those start on page 8 of the amendment. Excuse me, 15A, 15B of the amendment. You get it. Creates a new advisory committee called the Climate Investments in Disadvantaged Communities Advisory Committee, and the new section will specify who the members of that committee need to be. And this is an advisory committee that would work both with the Department of Transportation in the distribution of funds from the new climate investment account within the Highway Fund, and would also work with the Department of Environmental Quality in distribution of monies in the grant program to specifically advise them on the monies that are required to be distributed in relation to projects supporting disadvantaged, projects affecting disadvantaged communities. I believe that covers all of the major topics that are addressed by the amendment, and I'm happy to answer any other questions that the panel has.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah. Could you explain the Environmental Justice Task Force?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Senator Olson, the Environmental Justice Task Force is a statutory task force that already exists in, it's a standing task force that already exists in Oregon law. And I cannot at this time recall exactly what the composition of the members of the task force is, but it's an existing task force that's available for consultation with state agencies.
But this task force seems to have a considerable amount of power. I'm sorry, yeah. Follow up. This task force seems to have a considerable amount of power for this climate investment committee because they are to appoint 9 of the 17 members. So it seems to me that they will be the ones dictating the avenues that this investment fund will go down.
Could you clarify which? So the Environmental Justice Task Force, which fund it is, because it's not all funds. And we also have somebody that's going to be testifying later as to why the environmental justice aspect is important.
Okay. Well,
in the bill, so.
I would just say that on page 8 of the amendment, at the Climate Investments and Disadvantaged Communities Advisory Committee, consisting of 17 members appointed by the governor, but then it says at least 9 members must be recommended by the Environmental Justice Task Force to the governor. It seems to me that the Environmental Justice Task Force has a little bit of sway over this committee, and I just wondered if that was intended, or do these people have special cognitive powers that they know who should be on this advisory committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I think that
The existing task force, the focus of that task force is specifically on those areas that would be covered by the this advisory committee. So they, you know, they've been working on these issues, and so they've developed, you know, my understanding, a certain amount of expertise in this area, and I assume that's why it's that expertise that's being called on for recommending the members of this group, which will be focusing on the investment aspect of the issue.
I would say, as somebody that is engaged in a lot of discussions around many of these issues in developing this bill, the intention is that so there's the minimum number that have to be recommended by the Environmental Justice Task Force. It is so that there is an environmental justice perspective and vetting that is brought to the advisory committee, which doesn't have total authority for dispensation of those funds, but it is an advisory committee, and we want to have a strong environmental justice perspective on that. So there's a vetting process to, and doesn't mean that they would be members of the Environmental Justice Task Force per se, but rather they'd go through a vetting process by the Environmental Justice Task Force. Other questions for Maureen about the
actually, just
composition
comment
of the,
on what you were been discussing.
Yeah.
It appears that the preponderance of the funding of this this bill will come from the business community. And I don't see in reading the bill, and maybe as the testimony comes out, we will hear it different, but I don't see where the business community is remotely engaged in this bill in the distribution of this money.
And I think two things. One, not all of the committee, I do not consider all the committee language to be final on the, I believe there are four different committees that are established in the bill. Secondly, there's nothing that says that the business community can't, members of the business community can't be those appointees vetted by the Environmental Justice Task Force. I mean, there's nothing, those are not mutually exclusive things.
You're being serious.
I'm absolutely being serious. You know, there's nothing that stops the Environmental Justice Task Force from appointing a business person. And that's the point, is to make sure that environmental justice perspective is brought to the advisory committees. I wish you could have sat in on the phone calls that I had about this. This has been one of those, for everybody in the audience, this has been one of those issues that has been difficult to wrestle with, because there are perspectives that are way further left than mine. You know, I mean, politically left. So it's been interesting to try to find a balance that brings that environmental justice perspective to the bill, but in a way that, you know, feels like appropriate public process. And those conversations will continue.
Mr. Chair, could I ask two questions, please? First, when will that committee language be final so we could take a look at it? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, before we vote on it, I mean, at the point that it's, at every point along the way, it's, you're voting on what you're voting on, so.
Okay, and then secondly, how could anybody get further left than you?
So, well, you got somebody to.
Oh. I'm on your left.
That's right.
I'm on his right.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Maureen. Okay, we are going to go into some panels that we have, and then we have a number of people signed up. So let's just get to it. So first, we're going to call up a couple of folks from DEQ, Palmer Mason and Colin McConaughey. If you guys could come forward and answer questions and provide perspective from a, and I want to clarify that this is not a DEQ bill. This is a legislative bill. The DEQ has not taken a position on the bill, but we are, in fact, charging the DEQ with doing a bunch of stuff in the bill. So I think it would be appropriate that we hear from you how you would go about doing that should we pass this bill and should it be funded for you guys to do that work. Go ahead.
Go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me here today Colin McConaughey. Colin is our principal climate policy analyst. Before we talk about the things that Senator Edwards, the chair, has asked about, I do want to put a couple things on the record. One, as the chair alluded to, DEQ is neutral on the bill. Secondly, we are we've had a limited amount of time to look at the amendment, so most of our remarks will be tracking the bill as introduced. I think the amendment, as I understand it, largely keeps the task that DEQ has as outlined in the bill the same. There are some changes, of course, but I just want the committee to know that we haven't had a great deal of time to look at the amendment.
Nor has the chair.
So. Nor has anyone.
Yeah.
And then what I think we'll really try to talk about, just to give you the big picture, and then Colin will take you through it in more detail, is how DEQ would approach the bill as it's been drafted to establish the program. So most of the remarks that we're going to share with you today are around establishing the program. There is a separate point roughly in 2020, as the chair alluded to, when the program would be in operative and would go into implementation. And we can certainly take any questions about that. But again, what we're really going to try to focus on today is from the bill's inception up to the point of implementation. I would tell the committee and anybody listening, this would create a brand new program in DEQ. We don't do this work today, so we will be talking about a significant number of FTEs associated with doing this new program. And maybe it's as a given, but again, to put it clearly on the record, we're only going to be talking about the activities, the scope of work as it relates to DEQ. There are other agencies mentioned in the bill. We're not here to speak for them. We're only here to speak for DEQ.
Mr.
Chair.
Palmer, will you be able, before we vote on this bill, to give us a in the ballpark estimate of the annual cost of DEQ's involvement in implementing this bill?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I believe we could give you an estimate, but I want to tell you it would probably be an estimate.
Of course it would be an estimate, yes.
Right, but if I could just sort of share for you and the committee's perspective, the reason for saying that is we, of course, don't know what the ultimate rule would look like. And this, in the rule that I'm referring to, is the rules that set up the carbon pollution market. And how that would work. So I think we can give you some reasonable estimates, sort of based on our professional judgment of how this would work. But they would be estimates.
Thank you.
Yeah. If I can continue here, when we're describing what work DEQ would do to set up and establish the program, we're going to be sort of talking about three large topics. The scope of work, which is Colin's going to take you through, the sort of the steps that are required to set up the program, talk about our staffing to do that work, and then the contract dollars that we see we would need to have appropriated by the legislature to get outside expertise to implement a cost-effective, workable program. And with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Colin and introduce yourself again.
Thank you, Palmer. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colin McConaughey with the Department of Environmental Quality. And as Palmer just mentioned, I will walk through it at a very high level here, the main elements of developing the program as we're reading it here in the bill, then describe the staffing requirements and the contracting requirements as we see them right now. So the first element of our work as we see it, if this bill were passed, would be to establish new rules to put in place the greenhouse gas emission limits specified in the bill under Section 4. With those in place, as those were being developed, we could also begin the more considerable rulemaking process to develop the carbon pollution market that is described in Sections 9, 10, and 11. That would establish the trading platform for the emission allowances and establish the mechanisms by which those allowances would be allocated, either through consignment to the utilities, as we heard earlier, or through auction. Once that program is established, the other eight major elements in the bill in Sections 12 through 17 pertain to the disbursement of revenue generated by that carbon pollution market. Of these, the disbursement program that would be run by DEQ and overseen by the EQC is the Oregon Climate Investment Fund. And this would pertain to revenues from auction of allowances that were not purchased by the transportation sector. It appears that the disbursement of these funds would need to go, at least 40% of those funds would need to be distributed to projects located geographically within disadvantaged communities, and 40% would need to be distributed to projects geographically located in economically distressed areas. To be honest, that is the extent of the broad brushstroke level of the major programs that would need to be developed by DEQ. As we mentioned, we've done an initial estimate of the staffing requirements to do that, to develop the program as designed in the bill. And we think the first order of business there for DEQ would be to hire a manager to oversee the new program and one senior program analyst or policy analyst to begin the rulemaking process for the greenhouse gas emission limits rule. And then shortly thereafter to hire two additional policy analysts to begin designing the carbon pollution market.
Do you have a cost estimate on those?
Okay. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we do have a cost estimate in our fiscal. We also anticipate the need for an additional FTE to provide kind of program and coordination and technical support to the manager and those policy analysts, as well as an IT specialist to design and begin running the computer software systems needed to run the carbon pollution market. And then finally, the final piece of the cost estimate in this fiscal is approximately $500,000 that we estimate over the next two bienniums for contracting with consultants to cover the assessment of the economic effects of the program, as well as to study the feasibility of incorporating life cycle emissions in our greenhouse gas reporting program.
And if I might add, to speak to Chair Edwards, to the Vice Chair's question about the cost, I'll break it down by biennium. So 15-17, it's roughly $631,000 of general fund. And then in the 2017 to 2019 biennium, it's roughly $2.1 million of general fund. And what this does, that if the legislature appropriates that money to DEQ, is it leads us to the establishment of the program. And as the chair alluded, then in 2020, assuming the program is going forward after the 2019 legislative session, the EQC, DEQ would then be able to pay for the program out of the fee language that's provided in the bill. So there's an initial set of costs that come with developing the program, and then once the program is implemented, there's a mechanism in the bill to pay for our ongoing work.
Thank you, Palmer. I think we'll close there and be open for any questions.
Thank you both. Senator Woodson.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. McConaughey, as I understand it, by rule, DEQ will set the limits of the greenhouse gas emissions, develop the trading market for the greenhouse gas emissions and the auction, create the allowances, disperse the funds, and develop the program for DEQ to fund itself all by rule?
Chair Edwards, Senator Witt said, yes, we would need to adopt rules to do all of that. Much of that is defined in the bill language, such as those emission limits.
And if I might, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, there is, of course, other parts of the bill that speak to other agencies. They would be getting some of the auction proceeds to spend. That would be their work. Just for DEQ, though, yes, I think most of the activities require rulemaking. So we would go through a public process, and it would ultimately be decided by the EQC when it comes to the final rule.
Mr. Chair, will we be hearing from the other agencies who will be... that's hearing other agencies that will be having funding
scheduled for this hearing as a PUC.
Okay.
And then we don't have ODOT on the schedule, but ODOT is involved to the extent that we bring transportation fuels in.
Be very useful to have that. And one other question for Mr. Palmer. You were very careful to say that DEQ would have need so much general fund. And then I assume as when this program gets up to 2020, it'll be run on other funds, meaning you'll be charging the people you're regulating. But between now and 2020, will all of your funding come from a general fund, or will there be other funds?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, it's really a question for the legislature. When we were putting this fiscal together to consider what it would cost to set this program up. We assumed the source of dollars would be general funds to pay for it. So yes, we're contemplating that there would be an appropriation from the legislature in the amount of general fund and basically in the amounts that we were just talking about.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
In preparation for this bill, you knew this bill was out there and working forward and stuff like that, and you've actually provided me with several charts on folks that actually produce CO2. Have you done any modeling to determine how much CO2 reduction we would have once this program started?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the reductions would seem, at least at face value, to be the level at which the cap declines, which given the current amendment, and we, as Palmer mentioned, have had very limited time to review that, would be the emission limits that are prescribed in the bill as introduced, basically multiplied by the proportion of the sectors the covered entities. So the limits are those prescribed in the bill, adjusted for the proportion of the entities in the state that are covered by this program.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
So what DEQ would do, we'll say, for example, we'll just take Ash Grove Cement. They put out 694,000 metric tons. You will come in 2020 and say you're allowed to put that out, but you must buy credits above 25,000, and then you must reduce every year after that a percentage. Is that correct? Is that what this bill would do?
Senator Olson, excuse me. I don't believe it would work that way. If I understand how a program like this operates, they would be allowed to purchase emission allowances on the marketplace sufficient to cover their emissions. They would not be held to any prescribed limit. That's the market mechanism of a program.
Which is the point I'm trying to make. They don't have to reduce their emissions, but they can pay for credits to still emit exactly what they're emitting, but pay for credits to buy their pollution. So we don't reduce carbon dioxide, but we do reduce somebody's pocketbook.
Senator Olson, we do end up collectively reducing emissions. We, in this example, may not achieve those emission reductions at Ash Grove if their demand for allowances is greater than other industries, say, and they acquire or purchase allowances sufficient to maintain their current output of emissions. But we know, because the total pool of allowances is declining, as described in the bill, that collectively the statewide emissions are being reduced at the levels defined.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
On the offset emissions, since it's going to be only inside the state and California can't
live on their offset emissions inside their state. They have to go outside. How would you handle that? Because we would have such a lack of credits available. What would DEQ to make certain that the whole market, the whole program wouldn't fall apart?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I guess I'll start with that question. So when we go to set up the program, and particularly the allowance program, the trading part of the program, we'll be looking into the economic impact of the program. That was one of the reasons why we specifically have called out professional services dollars, so we can hire economists to help us, you know, figure out that question of the economic impact. I'm not an expert in this issue, but I'm not aware that California is having per se a problem with the offset market. But maybe there's some information you have that we don't have, and we'd certainly welcome looking at it. I think the idea behind the offset market, as I understand it, and Colin can certainly add more to this, is that the offset market gives covered entities, who are the parties who have to buy the right to emit greenhouse gases, as you were characterizing it, it gives them another option, another flexible option to try to manage their greenhouse gas emissions. So it creates an additional market opportunity to go and meet or another additional market opportunity, I should be very careful about how I say this, to admit the greenhouse gas related emissions that they have for their operations. So we would look at how to set up the offset program in a way that complements the allowance program. That would, I think, at a staff level, be our recommendation to the EQC.
And I do think that to this issue, and we have some people coming up later that probably know more about the specifics of the California market, but as I understand it, I could be wrong. I definitely could be totally wrong here, and somebody feel free to correct me if I am, but that California's currently their offsets or investments are required to be in state. In the state of California. Okay, totally wrong. Everybody's going, no, that's not right. Okay, so I will get corrected. And then the second thing is that I want clarification on is how it is contemplated by how other markets like the California market and how the department and the EQC might handle accommodations, because it has been so. Senator Olson brought up a really good point. I and I believe Senator Beyer have been very concerned about the prospect of leakage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it does nobody any good to shut down a manufacturing facility here, so a manufacturing facility in another state that's not in such a regulatory regime can move the production, move the jobs there, and move the emissions there. And you just have leakage out of this state and into another state. And so I was of the understanding that one of the ways to accommodate those type of energy-intensive and trade-exposed industries is not only in the granting of all the necessary allowances, but also the price of the allowance. I mean, the allowances could be for free. So I am also interested in more of that information, in which case we don't have a situation, which I think you're rightly concerned about, where people are paying because of the potential of leakage, you know, paying, and, you know, it's a cost to their bottom line, and that cost doesn't address leakage if it's a really high number.
I might be mistaken on this, but I think California has three companies up here, or three entities up in Oregon that they buy offset markets.
Yeah, right. And I was obviously incorrect about that, because I knew at one point they did, but I didn't realize that was still happening. Senator Denbro, then Senator Whitsitt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, I am very attracted to this notion of, you know, focusing on Oregon offsets in Oregon. I think obviously that's something that if we can do it, we should do it. Is it your opinion that we can do that? Is that something that you'll be sort of testing during the rulemaking and the modeling that you'll be doing? And is it possible you'll come back to us and say, you know, we think we're going to need more flexibility, or at this point, does it seem like that's something that, you know, obviously for the benefits to the Oregon economy, we would like to see happen?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, it's a very good question. To be quite candid, I don't think we've actually looked at it that closely yet to address that. I think there are several considerations. One, we want to make sure that if the legislature enacts a program, we implement or enact a program that's as workable and cost-effective as possible. A case could be made either way about whether it's better to have offsets just in Oregon or they can be on a broader marketplace. So we would have to look very carefully at that question. Of course, as the amendment was explained to us, they're now limited, if that amendment were adopted, to Oregon, and we would be implementing what the law dictates. But if you all, the committee, would like us to look at that and help in any way, whether it be conversations with California or elsewhere about where we should geographically limit or not offsets, we're certainly willing to help. But in answer to your question, in short, we haven't really looked at it that closely yet.
Sir, what's it?
Thank you. Palmer, as I read this bill, the idea is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions over time by force the reduction of greenhouse gas emission over time by reducing the number of allowances, and that may work. It also seems to assume that technological improvements and technology will allow for less emissions per unit of energy over time, and so I guess my point is if that technological advancement does not occur in the same time frame as you're ratcheting down the allowances, is there in this bill, or do I contemplate in your rules, a cap on how high the cost of the allowance could be? That's the first question. And the second, can you model the different scenarios as in the perfect system, the technology keeps up with the allowances? What if it doesn't? Can you model that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I think that's an excellent question, because I do think that over time, and certainly over the years that we're talking about, in order to meet the type of goals that we're talking about, particularly the 2075 goal, we're going to probably need to see technological advances. I think the thinking behind the cap and invest program or a cap and trade program is that price signal is sent through the marketplace through the sale of those allowances to incentivize that kind of action. But it is a good question to say that far in the future, how much of that technological change is going to happen. As we understand the bill and the amendment, the EQC does not have the authority to cap the cost of the allowances. There is a mechanism, though, in the bill where the EQC, DEQ, is directed to put allowances in a reserve to help manage the cost of that if there are prices start to go upward. That is one mechanism that the bill does provide the EQC, DEQ, to help manage the cost.
Paula,
yeah.
I don't see how once you start into a price escalation on allowances, how reducing the demand further by putting some in a reserve is going to improve the price of the allowances.
If I may, sure. Senator Woods, I think the thinking is it's the law of supply and demand. The demand is fairly fixed because the schedule is a gradual schedule in terms of the number of allowances that are needed by all the entities to meet the greenhouse gas emission limits. But by having the department hold some allowances off to the side, and they're not available in the marketplace until we release them, but if we do release them, we increase the supply of allowances. And again, if you go with Adam Smith and the law of supply and demand, the theory goes that additional supply with a fixed demand will lower the cost. So that I think is the thinking behind that particular mechanism.
I understand. I think I understand, but not to beat it to death, but if you already have a shortage of allowance that's driving the price up, taking more and setting it aside as a reserve doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for being here. We've got a lot of people to get through, so we're just going to keep moving right along. Next up, Carrie Neeson, Jason Barbos, and George Waldbuster. And our vice chair is choosing to invoke his right as vice chair to swear in the witnesses. If you would like me to read what your rights are again, did you go through that before?
Yes, we did.
Did you go through the part where they don't have to?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I couldn't remember, so I didn't know what you read.
You were nervous.
We're now in a situation, I was not in the room, but I would caution us to make certain everyone that comes before us that's going to be put under oath is asked those questions before they are put under oath, because someone may not be in this room, did not hear the their rights.
That's a fair...
Appropriate?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I won't read the whole preamble to this. I am just going to state that the vice chair is within his rights to swear you in. You do not, and you have rights too. You do not have to swear an oath. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. So, with that, Beth.
Will you please raise your right hand, all three of you? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Thank you.
Thank you each. Who would like to start?
I'll go. I wasn't nervous until I had to do that. I've never had to do that before. Thanks for the experience, I guess I'll say.
Very uncommon.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Mountain Pacific. And our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. We began our work over 100 years ago. We first started fighting tuberculosis. We continue today fighting against tobacco. And today we find ourselves with a new challenge, and that's climate change. Climate change presents one of the greatest threats to human health we have ever faced. Increased unhealthy air quality, climate-induced wildfires, crop loss, infectious diseases, and disasters from extreme weather give us an extraordinarily high human and financial cost. The status quo on climate change is unacceptable. Our response must be bold, and we need to take action now. Climate change is a great threat multiplier. Warming temperatures exacerbate the conditions that make air quality worse. Poor air quality sickens people who are most vulnerable, our children, the elderly, and people with existing lung conditions and other chronic diseases. So when I think about climate change, Oregon's youth come into mind, as do all of the 420,000 Oregonians with asthma. 80% of our lung development happens after we're born, so youth exposed to air toxins and air pollution are at increased risk for infection and disease. If you've ever been around someone with an asthma exacerbation, it's a frightening event. The first time I ever experienced this, I was in the emergency room, and it was a young child that was struggling for each and every breath. And it reminded me of the feeling that I had when I was a klutz growing up, and I fell down the basement stairs once, and I had the air knocked out of me. And that experience seemed to be the same as this young child with asthma was having. Both of us just didn't know when we would get our next breath. And for people with asthma, it happens way too often. Asthma not only impacts the quality of life for these individuals, but it also takes an economic toll. Kids miss school, adults miss work. An average asthma hospitalization costs $14,000. Annual hospitalization costs for Oregon are over $28 million. I also think about Oregon's nearly 200,000 residents with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. For these individuals, each and every breath can be a struggle. This fall, I lost my dad to COPD, and I saw his struggle to live and to breathe, and that will be with me forever. Climate change will increase the challenges for this vulnerable population and for their challenges that they have with breathing. We must address climate pollution as we have addressed other public health threats. Senate Bill 1574 is a step in the right direction. For those who say addressing climate change is too costly, I say we can't afford to do nothing. It's the health and future of our children, the health and future of my nieces and nephews. It's the health and future of our families, our communities, and our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Jason?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. My name's Jason Barbos, and I'm the Western States Policy Manager with the Union of Concerned Scientists. We are a nonprofit organization that puts rigorous science to work to advance a healthier planet and a safer world. And one of our top priorities is helping people and elected officials respond to the challenge of climate change. And before getting to the merits of the bill, I think it's important to note that you all are considering this legislation at an incredibly significant moment in the global response to climate change. It was mentioned at the beginning of the hearing that just 2 months ago in Paris, 195 nations agreed to a shared responsibility to keep global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius and to drive efforts to limit the temperature increase even further to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And what you should know about that is that objective likely requires achieving net zero emissions of carbon dioxide between 2050 and 2070. And while presidents and prime ministers made the trip to Paris, we know their commitments are made real by legislative leaders like you, who implement climate-protecting policies at the local level. And therefore, it's imperative to you, I imagine, that you find and adopt and implement policies that effectively reduce emissions while also protecting consumers and the economy and vulnerable communities and industries. And our organization believes that a market-based cap on global warming emissions, as envisioned by SB 1574, is such a policy. It's a smart, powerful, and flexible tool to address climate change. And simply put, a price on carbon makes it more expensive to emit carbon. And that means that producers and consumers will seek ways to cut back on their use of technologies and products that generate carbon. It means that decisions will better reflect the true cost of doing business, and there will be a market incentive to invest in measures that will help cut emissions as well as ramp up technologies that produce low or zero carbon energy or increase energy efficiency. And one of the main points I want to make is that in adopting this bill, this has been touched on, but Oregon will be joining other states and provinces and countries that are successfully reducing emissions with a price on carbon pollution. So you have the European Union that adopted the world's first carbon cap and trade program launched in 2005, 11 years ago. You have British Columbia that implemented a carbon tax in 2008. 9 Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states that have been successfully reducing carbon dioxide from power plants through a regional cap and trade program since 2009. California has a multi-sector cap and trade program, very similar to the program proposed in this bill, in operation since 2013. Quebec fully linked with that program in 2014, and Ontario is soon to join as well. Meanwhile, many more states are considering carbon trading programs as part of their compliance with the Federal Clean Power Plan. You have China that's launched a number of pilot cap and trade programs at the provincial level and intends to launch a national program in the next few years. All told, nearly one quarter of the world's carbon pollution will be priced by the end of this year. And there are numerous large corporations that already use an internal price on carbon pollution to inform their business decisions. So this laundry list I offer to you to stress the point that this is not a hypothetical policy tool. It is a tested tool that has been refined with each new iteration and is succeeding in cost-effectively reducing pollution. And Oregon has the chance to build on these successful examples to create a program that reduces pollution and meets the unique needs of Oregonians. And while there are small refinements that could be made, we believe this is a strong proposal that will harness the power of the market to drive down emissions cost-effectively. and it will serve as an important complement to other low-carbon policies, such as programs to increase the use of renewable energy or low-carbon fuels, by providing an important backstop to those programs to ensure we meet our emissions goals. And for these reasons, we request your support for SB 1574. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. George.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to listen to us today. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. I'm here as a member of the faculty today.
Could you pull the mic just sure. a little bit closer?
My expertise is in ocean acidification, which has been deemed the evil twin of climate change, and it's a consequence of increasing CO2 absorption by the oceans. And I'm also here as a concerned citizen for the future of our planet. My testimony and support for this bill is my own. It doesn't represent Oregon State University. I do have to note that this bill will help Oregon's businesses and future citizens by stemming the state's carbon dioxide emissions, thus helping to offset climate change impacts on Oregon's living resources, and providing much-needed leadership for the country as a whole. It really is time to move past a debate about whether the combustion of fossil fuel is contributing to the changing and warming climate. Let me assure you, the scientific consensus is clear on this. Climate change is man-made and occurring. A recent study tried to put this into perspective and found that the likelihood that the last 13 to 15 warmest years since 2000 in the Northern Hemisphere being due only to natural causes was 1 in 170,000. That's about 10 times more like you're 10 times more likely to be struck by lightning than climate change did not be caused by anthropogenic carbon emissions. But I really want to talk about ocean acidification impacts on marine organisms. I've been working on this topic for nearly a decade now. I've published over 30 scientific papers on this in the past 7 years. I've served on several state and regional advisory panels and have participated in workshops with shellfish growers, industry people, in fact, who are concerned about this issue in the U.S., New Zealand, Chile, France, and Canada. I would be remiss not to, however, acknowledge the extensive agricultural and tourism industries in Oregon that stand to be impacted directly by the increasingly erratic weather, changes in mountain snowpack, and rising sea levels due to climate change. In 2007, the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery in Etarts Bay, Oregon, began experiencing unprecedented oyster seed production failures. The operators of this hatchery had over 30 years' experience and had never previously seen failures of this persistence and magnitude. This hatchery historically supplied the majority of small oyster growers up and down the U.S. West Coast, as many as 70% by some estimates. Another hatchery in Washington State, run by Taylor Shellfish, was also seeing this increase in production failures around the same time. And natural recruitment of oysters in Willapa Bay, Washington, the primary seed source for growers not relying on hatcheries, was also economically unviable. These collective events, termed the oyster seed crisis by the media, threaten an industry that supports thousands of living wage jobs along the rural U.S. West Coast, including Oregon. The diligence of the hatchery operators in Oregon, the collaborations with Oregon State University, and federal scientists allowed us to identify the root cause of these failures as being excess carbon dioxide levels in the coastal ocean. This finding permitted implementation of adaptation strategies that helped to preserve this industry that supported generations of watermen up and down the Oregon coast. The industry is not entirely resilient, however, at this point. While we can amend water in the hatcheries to reduce carbon dioxide, our options in the natural environment are far more limited and only constitute stopgap measures until real efforts are made to reduce carbon emissions. I must repeat this. The only real long-term solution to protecting Oregon's coastal marine resources is capping carbon emissions. The oyster example is a well-documented one, illustrating the impacts of excess anthropogenic carbon is having today on Oregon's marine resources. Pteropods, otherwise known as sea butterflies, are also important salmon food and have been documented with dissolving shells in the past couple of years in Oregon waters by federal scientists. It is currently unknown whether salmon will be able to adequately shift diet should pteropod populations diminish, but an abundance of scientific studies have highlighted that these impacts are not unique or unusual for a wide range of marine organisms. The current scientific literature suggests about half of marine organisms that have been tested thus far are susceptible to ocean acidification. While we can linger on the unknowns and probabilities of what may or may not happen, we are currently today impacting important species at the base of oceanic food webs and our own food supply. And our best scientific understanding suggests that inaction on carbon reduction will have dire consequences for these marine ecosystems. So I implore you, without concerted efforts, to organize and work towards reductions in carbon emissions We will continue to increase the likelihood and declines of economically and ecologically important fish and shellfish populations along the Oregon coast. I hope the concern for Oregon's watermen that rely on marine resources as well as the agricultural and tourism sectors far outweighs the fear that we don't understand enough to act today. I'm here to state unequivocally the science is in. Lack of action on carbon emissions will only contribute to worsening conditions for many of Oregon's marine resources, resources that are iconic parts of Oregon's history, culture, and economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt?
Yeah, yes, I do. Several questions for the first witness. Were your statements regarding the alleged climate change effects on outcomes, were those opinion or were those hypotheses or were those declaratory?
I've got some studies. I'd be happy to get those to you.
I have studies that say the opposite. So the question was, are they opinion, hypotheses, or statements of fact?
I will say statement of fact then, sir.
Or your
As for
opinion,
clarification.
Then. Yeah.
Because, I mean, we now have these individuals under oath.
Yeah,
I think it's only fair to, based on what you read, that's their projection of what they're stating. You're just interpreting what you believe they're stating as compared to you're saying it's, you're not saying it's absolute fact based on your own.
Yes, thank you.
That was it.
I'm sorry, your question kind of took me back. So.
I have a question for the second witness. You repeatedly used carbon in your presentation. Carbon only occurs on the planet in the form of diamonds and graphite. So I'm assuming you were talking about carbon dioxide.
Thank you, for the Chair Edwards. Yep. And Senator Whitsitt. Thank you for the clarification. I was using the term carbon as shorthand for carbon pollution and other global warming gases that contribute to climate change.
Thank you. And the third, for the third witness, Doctor, could you discuss the extent of the greenhouse gas emissions and potential ocean acidification that is occurring through the thousands of volcanoes under the ocean and the huge amounts of greenhouse gases that have been recently determined to be escaping from the rifts in the tectonic plate separation?
Yes, that's a great question. The volcanoes are underwater volcanoes are contributing almost nothing to the changes in the ocean chemistry we're seeing today. The actual amount of that contribution is quite small. And it's orders of magnitude smaller than what we are producing in burning fossil fuels and emitting carbon dioxide. And we can determine that by tracers in the carbon that we call isotopes, and we know where that carbon comes from. And that CO2 that's emitted from those volcanoes are not what's contributing to the changes in pH that we see today in the ocean.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do I call you Dr. Welbusser? Or?
Sure, that would be fine.
Or Dr. Welbusser?
George is fine, too.
I have a bad shoulder. a question. You just mentioned it piqued my interest when you said that you're able to trace carbon dioxide. Are you saying that we have ocean acidification off the coast of Oregon due to Oregon's CO2 output?
No, we cannot trace the emissions from specific states. But we know that the changes in the ocean chemistry that we're seeing today that have been documented over decades that we know are occurring are, in fact, due to fossil fuel emissions. We cannot right now attribute how much our contribution is adding to that as a state.
Follow-up question? Yeah. Do you assume that allowing China to add a few hundred billion metric tons of carbon dioxide to the air will be any more productive than if we reduce a small portion of ours?
No. There's a mass balance there, and certainly China's emissions will contribute to increasingly poor conditions in the ocean. But again, I would agree with the chair in all due respect that without action somewhere, we're going to continue to go down this path, and there are people today that are impacted economically from this problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you each for being here. So we've got, in 20 minutes, this committee needs to recess, and we have a mandatory training that the members here have to attend, and then we will be coming back at 6:00 to hear from some more folks. Until then, we're probably going to be able to get through one more panel, which is a panel of opponents. and then some folks that have come from more than 100 miles away that aren't a part of a panel, so that they can hit the road and start their longer journey home this evening if they choose. And then when we come back, we'll hear from a final panel, and then as long as that doesn't take too long, we may hear from a couple more people, or we may just wrap up then. Anybody that doesn't, that we don't get through, we will carry over. If they were signed up today, will be carried over to tomorrow evening's hearing, where we have some other things on the agenda that we will be taking up. But and so specifically, we know that we will not get to the utility panel or the PUC tonight. So if you're with the PUC or the utility panel, we will not get to you tonight, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night. So with that, Senator Poznanski.
Mr. Chair, again, I think for priority or parliamentary procedure issues, what I'm hearing is that if they're signed up today, they'll have the opportunity to speak tomorrow, but this is not going to be opening the door for new people to come in.
Correct.
So we don't want people showing up to think they're...
Correct. Thank you for that clarification, Senator. Tomorrow night will be to finish up the list of people that had signed up today, but we just, because of the course of time and good and thoughtful questions by members of the committee, taking the time with this bill, we're just going to have to extend it one more evening. So.
Mr. Chair, if I may interject and make a suggestion, and you can take this for what it's worth, those folks that came from 100 miles away, it'd be nice to get them done so that they can head home rather than wait till 6 or 7 o'clock at night.
At least one of the panelists. I want to get them done by 5. So we have one more panel than those that came from more than 100 miles away, then we're out of here.
Okay.
For 1 hour.
All right.
So Kirk Hannawalt, Susan Morgan, and Glenn Lewis. Okay.
Trying to be fair.
The vice chair has requested to swear in this panel as well.
Just trying to be fair and even-handed for everyone.
Would you like me to repeat your rights, or did you hear the one I read last time?
I heard it.
You heard it? Okay. You're comfortable? Okay.
So, will the panel please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Okay. I don't know if you guys have coordinated at all, or no. Commissioner Morgan, would you like to kick us off?
I'd be honored to. Thank you very much, Chair Edwards.
And welcome back.
Okay.
And welcome back to the Capitol.
I'm sure. Is it on?
It is.
For the record, my name's Susan Morgan, and I'm a commissioner in Douglas County. Thank you for allowing me to speak about Senate Bill 1574. The citizens of Douglas County place a high priority on our environment. Clean air, clean water, and good habitat for wildlife are the basis of our economy and our beloved outdoor recreation lifestyle. As an example, take a look at the number of people, organizations, and businesses involved in our Fisheries Enhancement Derby and Auction. And that's a part of the handout that I gave you. For 24 years, this event has helped pay for many, many miles of improved habitat and water quality in Douglas County. We love our part of the state, we love our environment, and we want to watch out for our vulnerable citizens. We are Oregonians looking to ensure a bright future for all, but I can't support this bill, and I encourage you to oppose it as well. Let me tell you why. Earlier this month, the United Way came out with a new report that takes a look at the number of citizens who meet the federal poverty level in our state. A most interesting aspect to this report talks about the working poor, what they call the ALICE, asset limited, income constrained, unemployed. These are the hardworking people in my county and yours that are doing all they can to make ends meet, and they're in survival mode. Today in Douglas County, 43%, that's almost half of the people that I represent, were identified as struggling to meet their basic needs. And in my county, these numbers aren't improving. In 2007, this report cites that 39% of the families in Douglas County fit this definition. In 2010, which was midway through the Great Recession, it ticked up to 40%. And the latest figures from 2013 show that the number has increased to 43%. Senate Bill 1574 adds up to a terrible deal for my county and for the rural parts of our state that are already hurting the most. These families can't afford up to a 30% increase in electric and utility bills. We can't afford an extra $55 a month on the price of gas, and we can't afford to see any more of our good-paying jobs leave our community. Senators, I strongly urge you to seek environmental opportunities that also grow economic and social sustainability and provide a measure of stability for all rural Oregon families. And I've provided you a web citation to the United Way report. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead. Okay.
Chairman Edwards and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Kirk Hanawalt. I represent the Entech family of companies in Lebanon, Oregon. I have been with the company for 21 years. I'm president of the manufacturing division and one of the owners of the company. We operate production facilities here in Lebanon, Oregon, and also in Newcastle, England. We've been part of the Lebanon community for 30 years now, and we founded our business as a startup there with a handful of employees. We now employ 350 associates in Lebanon, Oregon. We make two kinds of battery separators. It's a plastic sheet that's used in batteries for both cars and forklifts, standby power, and we also make battery separators for lithium-ion batteries, which are used in handheld electronics. 95% of our products on the car, forklift, and truck area are exported from Oregon, and we export primarily to Asia and outside the boundaries of the state of Oregon in the U.S. And about 100% of our lithium-ion separators are exported, mostly to China and Korea. Our products, they're a critical component of batteries. Batteries are a critical component of reducing fossil fuel use, and so we're proud to be part of that economy. Since 2011, we have added new production lines totaling $60 million in investment while continuing to invest in emissions control technology. We are committed to continue to reduce our total emissions footprint over the last 5 years, we've invested approximately $10 million in new emissions controls. However, Entech's products and recycling processes are inherently energy intensive. We use electricity to run motors and heaters to melt and mix plastics. We use natural gas to generate steam. Reducing energy consumption and costs is important to our company. In 2013, we invested $2 million in a high-efficiency, low-NOx boiler to improve our steam generation capacity and efficiency. We use premium efficiency motors. We have auto-off fluorescent lighting throughout the facility. We design heat recovery into our processes, and we have a full-time employee whose job it is to insulate pipes to minimize energy loss. Entech has made and continues to make investments to reduce our unit consumption of energy. However, our energy use is not very elastic. Melting plastics and recycling process oils takes a large and relatively fixed amount of energy. Entech has seen estimates that our natural gas usage may cost us as much as an additional $1.6 million in 2025 and perhaps as much as $4 million in 2035. Our electricity bill will also increase dramatically, although we're not sure by how much at this point. Our competition is located entirely outside the state of Oregon, primarily in the eastern United States, in Europe, and in Asia. We are in a very competitive manufacturing environment for all the products we make, and especially in the separators we make for handheld electronics with lithium-ion batteries. Our sales for these products are nearly 100% in Asia, principally China and Korea, and our competition in China is reputed to receive both direct and indirect subsidies from the Chinese government. Our competitors will not have to pay the Oregon carbon levy, so Entech will become less competitive in the global market. Products that are marginally profitable for us today will be unprofitable, and NTEC will have to stop making these products. We will have less money to invest in our business. We will have less money to expand our business and grow jobs in Oregon. Forcing companies like ours to remove jobs from Oregon's clean climate and move production to high-carbon states or countries is really counter to the purpose of this legislation, but we fear that that is what will happen. As a father of two children and a citizen of Oregon, I'm very concerned about the long-term prospects of climate change, but unilateral action by Oregon will have negative consequences that will outweigh the benefits of this bill. I, on behalf of NTEC, my fellow owners, and the 350 employees of that company, urge a no vote on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1574. My name is Glenn Lewis. I'm on the advisory board for Hood River Juice Company. We produce nearly 100,000 tons of juice products, apple juice products, shipping primarily in the western United States. My background is in operations, energy, and supply chain management. I'm the vice chair of the Northwest Food Processors Energy Committee, which is the food industry for Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. I'm a former director of energy for all Del Monte Foods U.S. operations. So I approach this from the lens of competitiveness, coming from an operations perspective. When I've done major scale operations energy projects throughout my career, and I always look at it first from the paramount perspective of competitiveness before we get into the at a strategic level, before moving into the financials and tactical level details. So essentially, can this position the company to compete against anybody head-to-head anywhere in the world? So I'm used to dealing with a global competitive environment and try to position the company for that growth. For the Oregon food industry, it's about 30,000 food industry employees. I'm not sure what the total indirect employment is for the entire supply chain, but will be something north of 30,000. And from the information I've received from the NWFPA and its resources, this is essentially a $3 billion tax on Oregon and its constituents. So industry and residential, commercial, industrial and agriculture. So I would obviously go oppose this effort. Another key concern I have as I've read through this at a cursory level, I have read the bill one time in a synopsis, but apparently there is insufficient business representation in this effort. And I read, I recall earlier today, the Environmental Justice Task Force, and they may appoint business representation of to be determined what that criteria and prerequisite may be. I think for something of this importance and this magnitude for the state of Oregon, industry should have its own representation along with the other constituents here. So I'm not sure what the intent of that was, why business wasn't included, but it's definitely a need. And I know since 1990, per U.S. EPA data, Oregon industry has reduced CO2 emissions by 13%. And doing major projects over my career as you in demand-side management, energy efficiency work, demand response, energy efficiency, and other areas of wages, water, air, gas, electricity, and steam. As you do go forward with this, typically a net result of that is an improvement in your emissions profile. And that is somewhat usually indirect, but it does happen. And so I'm sure that has helped contribute to this 13% drop that I referenced. I know there has been this is to me a federal issue. Energy is typically regional, interstate, and the piecemeal approach of each state is unsound strategically. But I also recognize the inertia that has occurred from a federal level in doing this. So states want to do something, but it needs to be better planned and incorporate all the constituencies to ensure a vibrant, sustainable economy that benefits all. And I know during my career, there's a lot of regulatory and legislative islands without bridges sometimes. And the cumulative impact of those, where sometimes, well, it's only 4% here or 2% there, and it's looked at somewhat myopically in a absolute context versus a relative context. And so when you look at how it compounds on various regulations, today we're talking about climate change, but we also realistically, as my colleague here can testify, we deal with wage issues, we deal with a holistic view of all kinds of issues, and we have to look at them in a wide-angle lens and how they impact our competitiveness and vibrancy to be able to ensure that we can employ people and contribute to the economy now and in the future. So I've done a lot of work in public-private partnerships with the Department of the Air Force and other entities, and I'm glad to help in that collaboration of public-private efforts to advance something like this. I think you have to approach it, just given the federal state, that you do have to approach this. That might be the catalyst to help with at the federal level, but I think it needs to have more of an economic perspective. Also, I don't see this should have an objective economic assessment on what the impact is to the state of Oregon. That I haven't seen. Maybe that exists and I'm not aware of it, but I haven't seen anything that shows an objective economic assessment of this this bill. And thank you.
Thank you each. I have a question. Running out of time. So the last two gentlemen, both of you made reference to concern about a unilateral approach. It ought to be a federal approach. Have either of your companies or your trade associations advocated in Congress for, that's what leaves us stymied.
Sure.
Congress isn't acting.
You bet.
I've talked with plenty of business interests here in the state that said, whoa, you ought to be doing this federally.
You bet.
So I always ask, have you been to D.C.? Have you written to your congressman? Do your companies support a federal approach?
Yes.
Because often what's happening is in Congress, at the congressional level, there's opposition. And I'm not saying this is a question for you. And so there's opposition at the federal level. There's opposition at the state level. And just a whole bunch of games, and here we are. Nothing's being done. So that's a question.
So speaking for NTEC, we have not dealt with, frankly, any issue at the federal level. So we strictly have dealt on the local.
Or a trade association. I assume you're part of a trade association of some sort. And maybe you're not.
Associate Oregon Industries. So,
okay.
Yeah, local. Again, yeah,
okay.
We haven't tried to influence.
I'd love to ask them about that, too. So.
And the same. We approach it from a trade association perspective, a resource to help us in lobbying and getting that message out. Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Ms. Morgan, just to amplify your concerns, I did some quick calculations on three companies that you have in your district. Two are Roseburg Forest Products, and one is Douglas County Incorporated. And at the minimum of $12 a metric ton, it'll cost those entities about $10 million a year.
If I may comment?
Absolutely, please.
Yeah, and then I have some comments, too, because I don't think
again,
that's accurate
information. Again, for the record, Susan Morgan, Douglas County Commissioner. Thank you for those comments, Senator Olson. I might also point out that the timber industry accounts for about 30% of the jobs in my county, and those are some of our best-paying jobs. So we have great concern over how they're going to deal with those costs in terms of being able to continue to make the kinds of investments that they need to make in their equipment and in their facilities. Thank you.
And I do want to clarify that, and you and I, Senator Olson, need to sit down and compare our lists, because the list that I'm looking at of covered entities, Douglas County is not on the list, and Roseburg Forest Products, their gas, the emissions that come from their gas usage at the cogen plant would be, but their biomass-related emissions are not, and that's the bulk, but Roseburg Forest Products would have some that are covered. So we need to compare lists, because
I'm just taking mine straight from DEQ.
As am I, so that's weird. Okay. Or is DEQ?
We didn't swear DEQ in. That's our problem.
So, okay. Thank you each. So there are some folks. Can the folks from over 100 miles away, are you, so we have Irene Gilbert, who's in opposition, and we have Hans West, Deb Evans, and Alan Chournette, and Hannah Soule. So that's too many to hear from all of you. If you're going to be back when we reconvene at 6, we will hear you then. If you're hitting the road anyway, then I would be willing to hear from you, but we have a mandatory training that the members have to get to. So Irene is coming back at 6. The other individuals that were more than 100 miles away.
I can wait.
You can be back at 6. Okay. So then what we're going to do is we are going to recess until 6 o'clock, and while we go to our mandatory training that we have as legislators.
Is your list open?
So we are in recess.
Is your list open?
Back to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. We are going to pick up where we left off. We are still in our hearing on Senate Bill 1574. We're going to hear from just a couple more panels, and then we're going to call it good for the night, and we'll be back here tomorrow night and have an opportunity for people that have signed up to testify that aren't from further than 100 miles away to testify at that time. So we have a panel that I wanted to hear from, and we've also have some of the general public that is from further than 100 miles away. I'm going to call them first so that should they want to, they can hit the road because they have a longer drive than the rest of us to get home. So Irene Gilbert, all the way from Union County, and in opposition. And then we're all Oregonians. You guys won't fight with each other. Yeah, I know you're not all in the same opinion, but I'd also like to call up Hans West, Deb Evans, and Alan Jornet. And then the next panel that will be up will be Hannah Soule, Maggie Talmadge, Tom Bowerman, and Alan Zelenka, and then we are going to be done for the evening. And if you've signed up and we're not in one of those two panels, we will be having more testimony tomorrow evening in our hearing.
So, I was the fourth one called, and the third one doesn't seem to be there.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, to expedite the process, we won't be swearing these folks in.
Okay. So, Irene, would you like to start?
Thank you, Chairman Edwards and committee, for being here so late and listening to me.
And thank you for taking the effort to be here.
Okay. I am testifying in opposition to this bill. I heard a gentleman earlier say that we are takers in terms of CO2 and that we need to reduce our carbon footprint. I would say that not only are we not takers, we are givers in terms of providing other areas with renewable energy that has a very minimal carbon footprint. And what I base that on is Oregon has 1.24% of the population of the United States, but we produce only 0.68% of the CO2 emissions. So for our population, we have a very small carbon footprint. Not only that, but there are 12 states with more population than us who have who are producing, let's see, there are 12 states with less population who have more CO2 emissions than Oregon does. And every state with less CO2 emissions have less population than Oregon. So what we're saying is, for our population, we are in a very good situation in terms of the carbon that we are producing. I went through and got figures for the states with the least amount of carbon emissions per capita, and these are in metric tons, and I looked at the states that had single digits. So, for instance, Oregon had 9.63 CO2 emissions per capita in metric tons. Of the seven states that fell in that category, the average cost of electricity in Oregon was $8.97 for all sectors, cents per kilowatt hour. All of the other six states that have emissions within single digits, their cost per cents per kilowatt hour ran between $12 and 13 cents as the low, and the high was $16.86. So the states that have a carbon footprint that is even comparable at all to ours all have much higher electricity costs. And part of that, according to the information that I'm reading, and by the way, I'm happy to be under oath here, is because we have a lot of dam-generated energy, which is a fairly reasonable cost, or ours would also be much higher. The thing that concerns me about these kinds of hearings is the fact that, and I have the figures here for Oregon's consumption. The citizens of Oregon have a total consumption of 253.7 million BTUs per capita by all end users per 2013 data from the U.S. Energy Information Division. Now, so that's what we're consuming. What we're producing, however, is 458.8 trillion BTUs. So we are a net exporter of renewable energy. And again, depending on which figures you look at, the energy that's produced in Oregon is between 99.2% renewable and 99.8% renewable. So what's ended up happening in this state is, I think you'd all agree that the production of renewable energy has a cost associated with it. And it doesn't matter where it's coming from, whether it's coal generated or hydro, they're all going to have a cost. In the case of Oregon, we have surrounding states like California where 25% of their renewable energy is coming from other states. So that means that those other states, and Oregon is a major supplier for them, are assuming the cost of generating that energy. In the case of our state, because of policies that are implemented by the Department of Energy, and I look forward to commenting on Department of Energy, we have wind developments that are covering thousands of acres, and I looked at three of them that have between 399 and 400 megawatts rated capacity. The amount of habitat that is being required for those developments to protect because of their impacts to the habitat in this state was 10.71 for one, I believe that was Klondike. It was 30 acres for another, and a third one was like 24.7 acres. So what we're doing as a state is we are paying an incredible cost in terms of our wildlife and our natural resources to have these wind developments that you see all through the gorge. To me, what that's saying is we are paying for a low carbon footprint. We're not just paying for it for our state, we're paying it for surrounding states. We have Idaho next to us who is saying that they are now, because of the fact that they've changed their contracts to 2 years, they're going to move into Oregon. I believe it's 16 solar developments are moving to Oregon that they had planned to put into Idaho. So all in all, we're producing all this renewable energy for everyone else. We're sending it out of state, and because we are bringing in some energy that's been produced in other states who are not as don't have as clean a footprint as us, we are now supposed to be paying for that carbon in the energy that is brought in. Now, to me, we are providing clean energy for everyone else and for us to meet our total consumption, and we're already paying a huge price. It may not be in dollar bills that you see, but it certainly is in terms of our environment, our quality of life, just the whole, all of the resources of this state. You know, you've got a Department of Energy that's saying it's okay to kill 2.5 bats per megawatt of wind energy. They're saying that it's okay to kill like 60 birds for each of these wind farms, and a lot of them are endangered species or migratory birds. Those are costs that this state is assuming, and we can't afford it anymore. We're paying more than our dues. So I encourage you to keep that in mind when all these bills are coming up and say, we've done it. We've done our share. We've done your share. We've done everybody else's share. Somebody else needs to step up to the plate. Thank you.
Any questions? We'll hold questions till each of you have testified, and then we'll get to you.
Okay. I'll be happy to provide all the resources for everything I said, if you just want.
Okay. Next.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deb Evans, and I am here representing Hair on Fire Oregon, a group down in southern Oregon in Jackson County. We're here today to express our strong support for SB 1574, the Healthy Climate Act of 2016. We're a group of about 50 members, and we came together a year ago because we were scared. We're scared of the atypical weather we are starting to experience in southern Oregon. Weather like high wind, tropical storms on February 6th last year that dumped 3 inches of rain in 24 hours and knocked over thousands of trees where we live and closed Highway 66 with landslides. The back-to-back summers of drought bringing catastrophic wildfires, including the Oregon Gulch Fire in 2014 that burned 30,000 acres in 3 days, and that was 6 miles from our home. Last year's spring came 3 weeks early, followed by last fall. The first fall frost came 5 weeks late. For some of us, climate change isn't some faraway anomaly. It's right here in Oregon, and it's threatening the livelihoods of thousands of Oregonians. The name of our small but determined group is Hair on Fire Oregon because we see climate change as single-handedly the most urgent threat humanity has ever faced. We believe passionately that we can and must take action on climate before it is too late. Last session, we found ourselves in Salem multiple times promoting the Healthy Climate Act's predecessor, HB 3470. The members of our group heard the powerful testimony given by Secretary Rodriguez, California Air Resources Board, Sean Penrith, the Climate Trust, and Quebec Minister of Sustainability, David Hertel, at the House Energy and Environment hearings, all describing the remarkable positive economic impact states like California have experienced by capping and reducing greenhouse gas pollution, implementing social justice climate programs, and transitioning to clean energy economy. Since last session, Hair on Fire joined more than 18 concerned groups across the state whose sole focus has been to work with you, Senator Edwards, and others in the legislature to come up with a solid, comprehensive bill and mechanism that can give Oregon a path to a similar positive outcome. The Healthy Climate Act is the culmination of our efforts and is an incredibly exciting piece of legislation that would enforce Oregon's carbon pollution reduction goals, transition the state toward clean energy, and invest in economically disadvantaged communities. We have heard legislators question whether this bill should be passed in the short session. To that, we would like to remind the esteemed members of this committee, we cannot afford to wait. The costs to do nothing are far too high. The science says that we must reduce our greenhouse gas pollution by 7% per year starting now. Every year we wait, the percentage goes up. There is no more important bill being considered than this one in the 2016 session. Please join Oregon's legacy of courageous leaders and pass SB 1574, the Healthy Climate Act of 2016. If not for yourselves, then please do it for your grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Chairman Edwards, members of the committee, and members of the audience, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Alan Journay. I'm Professor Emeritus of Biology, Southeast Missouri State University, and co-facilitator of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. For several years now, we've been hearing politicians or commentators telling us they don't believe in climate science, or if it's happening, humans are not responsible. They then frequently follow this with the disclaimer, but I'm not a scientist. I am a scientist with a PhD and 30 years of experience teaching university-level biology and science process. I'm here to tell you that I don't believe in climate science either, just as I don't believe in the laws of thermodynamics, gravity, or atomic theory. I believe in none of these because belief is based on faith, on an incontrovertible commitment to an idea, regardless of evidence, whether in support or to the contrary. Science, on the other hand, relies on data, evidence, and a rational interpretation of what these suggest. Rather than believing in these well-accepted scientific ideas, I explore the data and the evidence and conclude that explanations offered by scientists in these fields represent the most reasonable and credible explanations for the world that exists around us. Science is how hypotheses are tested and falsified or supported. In the case of climate science, the conclusions are as confirmed as any conclusions in science ever will be. In the case of climate science, the evidence is clear that if we fail to curtail our emissions of greenhouse gases, we will be consigning our beautiful corner of this country to biological devastation. We can choose to continue as part of the problem, or we can become part of the solution by enacting a decreasing cap on the offending emissions. If we in Oregon wish to leave for our children and grandchildren a state that offers the wonders, beauty, and economic opportunity that we currently enjoy, we will do what we can to reduce our emissions. I live in rural Jackson County. I can testify that many residents in my area want the Oregon legislature to follow the example of other states and pass the Healthy Climate Bill. If we do this, just as one-fifth of the states in the country have already done, we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions without compromising economic growth. On behalf of the nearly 1,000 Southern Oregon residents who are Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, and on behalf of future generations in Oregon and across the globe, I urge you, support the Healthy Climate Bill, Senate Bill 1574, and let me note these are brief summaries of comments that I have submitted as written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions from members of the committee?
Just have a question for Ms. Ott. From the climate theory, and we're currently.
Who's it for, Senator? What's it? Hmm? Who's the question for, Senator?
Irene Ott.
Okay.
Yes, we're currently in the process of debating to site a 73-acre solar farm on EFU land, right adjacent to the Williamson River. Land which zoning does not allow homes to be built on, but we're going to cover with. So would you comment on, from your area, what is actually happening in the way of siting these facilities, the Energy Facility Siting Council's process, and the disparity between the rights of those companies and the rights of the people that own the land to put a house on it?
Well, and before you comment on that, there are entire hearings around this very topic last session. I know Irene could talk about this for 3 hours. We don't have 3 hours, so.
I will make it very quick. The Energy Facility Siting Council is very pro-developer. The rules are very pro-developer, for instance, not having to show a need. Therefore, Oregon is being inundated with these developments. I can tell you that when it comes to placing wind farms and high voltage transmission lines on high voltage or on high value farmland, there is no requirement for any kind of compensation for that. When it's on wildlife habitat, they're only compensating for the actual footprint, like of a power pole. So the actual impacts of these are significant. For instance, they want to put the Boardman to Hemingway transmission line right up a 4 mile. Calving area that calves about 1,000 elk calves every year, and that high voltage transmission line will destroy that area, which is considered number two next to Jackson Hole in terms of wildlife habitat for elk calves. So there really is no consideration. There are areas where you can't build a house. For instance, next to Wild and Scenic Rivers, they're placing turbines. Summit Ridge is placing turbines with between 1 mile and 4 miles off the edge of the Wild and Scenic Deschutes River, visible for 22 miles that seems to be okay. You can't build a home that you can see from the river, but you can build turbines. So everything is out the door in terms of protecting our environment when it comes to building these. And I hope the people who are looking at Department of Energy pay close attention to that.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
Any other questions?
I have one. Thank you very much. Since we haven't, we talk about climate, we talk about the carbon that's being put out. The one thing we don't talk about is the economy, the economics of this, because we don't have any idea what it's going to cost. So at what level are you comfortable with spending higher costs for energy, whether it be renewable, which because we've got a renewable bill out there that will raise costs, cap and trade bill, which will raise costs, and possibly IP28, which is a classic, you know, sales tax, if you will, but it's not sales tax. All of these are going to raise the cost for Oregonians. And as you've seen and you probably heard across the board, we're having some financial troubles. We've got some problems with employment and stuff like that in Douglas County, a classic example. So at what point in the economic ladder do you say enough is enough? Or is it just, Katie, don't bar the door, let the cat out, and we'll spend as much as we can?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, I'll try to answer how I would answer that question. Some of the numbers that I've put in my written testimony I didn't share with you, but climate change is a risk to the current economy in Oregon. So if you take agriculture and forestry, you take fisheries, you total tourism into that, all the impacts that they're projecting that will happen from anything from low snowpack, droughts, wildfire, increased wildfire, if you take that, those industries alone in Oregon account for $48 billion in revenue for this state. If you do nothing, those industries are at risk. So I would argue that in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reduce the threat of climate change, you will be stimulating jobs toward a clean energy economy. Those jobs, some have estimated to be 17 to 1 in clean energy versus fossil fuel energy. And if you look at California as an example, you know, they have over 50,000 jobs now created in the clean energy sector. So I would argue that if California can be used as an example, California shows that this can work. You can actually reduce greenhouse gases and stimulate the economy at the same time. So I don't see it as a threat to the economy. What I see as a threat to our economy is doing nothing, and the industries down where I live, agriculture, I mean, we had zero snowpack May of last year in the Ashland watershed. That we can't sustain that very many years in a row before agriculture in Jackson County goes by the wayside. So we're worried. We're worried for the fisheries, for salmon. We're worried, the testimony earlier, with ocean acidification. What happens if all these things come to pass? The cost of extreme weather events, I mean, the list goes on and on, wildfires. So the cost is high. Thank you.
We need to get to other panelists.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you each for sharing your perspective.
May I respond to the question? I'm not sure to whom it was directed.
Well, I think...
give a shot.
Go sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Succinctly, please.
As I indicated, I live in a rural part of the state. One of the components of this state is important forests. When we look at the impact of the business-as-usual consequences of greenhouse gas emissions and the temperatures in southern Oregon and throughout Oregon, what we find is the studies suggest that many of the incredibly important commercial tree species will be decreased tremendously in terms of their geographic range and viability, some of them to the extent, like the lodgepole pines, that it may not even exist within the state of Oregon. And to echo Deb's comments, not addressing this problem represents a serious economic choice. We have choices. We can either not address it and suffer economically, or we can address it, and as we have seen in places like California, the regional greenhouse gas initiative states out east, we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and we can support a growing economy. And I think the point that I would like to make again and again is if we are not part of the solution, we are part of the problem. And I really want to live in a state which is part of the solution. Thank you.
I'll just make one comment. Did you know that from the year 2000 to the year 2013, we've reduced our greenhouse gas output
by 16%, and we haven't done any of this. We've just done what we normally do through process. So we haven't done anything. So we're on a decline already. So the question becomes, once again, economic. How much can Oregonians tolerate to have to pay? Because I've read the studies also that indicate that, that forests and trees love carbon dioxide, and they actually grow better because of the excess that we might have, if we have an excess.
Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, would you like to discuss the issue of forest susceptibility to climate change in a separate forum? Because I'd be
I
delighted
would,
to talk with you about
because
it.
Because I'd like to debate you on what is climate change and what are weather patterns. Climate change is from long time weather pattern, and we'll do that in a separate forum. I'd love to sit down and talk to you. Absolutely.
Can I turn in, since my computer died, can I turn in my testimony later tonight or tomorrow?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I would love to be part of that debate. I could quote many studies.
What pizza house we go into and have a little pizza and a little cold drink?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I'm biting my tongue, man. Okay. So last panel of the evening, Hannah Soll, Maggie Talmadge, Tom Bowerman, Alan Zelenka. Thank you each for your patience.
Oh, we got four. How did we get four?
I'm signed up on this. Okay. Here.
No, that's fine. Whatever you say.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. In that order, please.
Doesn't have to be in that order. Any meaning, my name Maggie?
Good evening, Senator Edwards, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Talmadge. I'm the Environmental Justice Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. I'm the person that's more left. Senator Olson.
Oh, then
that's right.
All right.
She's sitting on this.
Yeah, oh, I got you.
They existed.
She's over
by. So the Coalition of Communities of Color is an alliance of 19 culturally specific community-based organizations. We have representation from 6 communities of color. So that's African, African American, Asian Pacific Islander, Latino, Native American, and Slavic. And again, we were founded in 2001, so we have very deep relationships within these communities. You know, communities of color and low-income communities, what we're dubbing disadvantaged communities in Oregon, really face economic, health, and environmental disparities already. Lack of access to green space, lack of access to healthy foods, increased distances to transportation, employment, high rates of unemployment, as well as high rent burden and housing instability, and additional environmental burdens. And couple this with the effects of pollution and climate change, which hit our communities first and worst and most severely, particularly because of the instability and the vulnerability of our communities as is. You know, our communities are already facing extremely high asthma rates, lack of salmon to sustain communities, which is a very cultural and...
Pardon me, lack of what? Did you say
salmon? Yeah.
Salmon fish?
Years in which salmon are not spawning as well,
And that relates to color, communities of color?
Tribes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
thank you. Shortened growing seasons, which affects not only growers, not only farmers, but farm workers and consumers. Heat-related illness and death. We see that, you know, in one particular community, which has a high rate of people of color in Portland, it's 9 degrees warmer than the rest of the city. So we see that, those environmental disparities as well as the health disparities that come with it. You know, and that's why really we support concepts like SB 1574. Really, it's putting us on a good track to protect not only Oregon's future, but our communities that are most vulnerable. But like climate change itself, poorly designed climate solutions can increase environmental burdens, as well as costs for disadvantaged communities. And furthermore, low-income communities are already underrepresented and decision-making, even though they're on the front lines of climate change. So, and this is really because, you know, communities of color, low-income communities are spending a high proportion of their income on transportation and energy. But we also recognize that equitable climate policy, as we've seen work in California, is a win-win. We are generating revenue to help disadvantaged communities, low-income communities, communities of color, with job creation, job training, educational opportunities. And it's, you know, also what this bill does is it increases Oregon's economic as well as infrastructural resilience. And that's huge. If we're looking at floods, who is affected most by floods in this state? It's usually people. If we look at a recent flood in Portland, I've got someone's back. It's really hitting communities of color, low-income communities, most. So this is really an opportunity to do a lot, mitigate climate change, provide job opportunities, and reduce disparities in communities of color, low-income communities. But, of course, we have to be intentional about these opportunities and creating these opportunities. And, you know, the CCC, as well as partner organizations, have developed a set of principles to apply to any climate or environmental policy. And that's pretty simple: prevent harm, provide benefit, and inclusive and accountable decision making. And we hope that, you know, SB 1574 provides a lot of this already. And so in preventing harm, I think we heard a lot of it earlier. We talked about, you know, offsets. And I think there's a big question about that. And, you know, I really support and I'm thankful for Senator Edwards' support on this of locating offsets within the state of Oregon and limiting those, because we know in order to prevent harm, we want to reduce the environmental burden, the pollution burden of low-income communities who are often situated near high pollution corridors. And we provide benefit, right? So reinvest the revenue really intentionally. We want to close opportunity gaps. We want to end disparities. And we want to ensure equitable distribution of good air quality, the related social, environmental, and economic benefits. And that's why we stand by delivering multiple co-benefits for any investment. We can target a rural community that may not have much economic industry and have an opportunity to really reinvest in infrastructure, whether it's through construction or whether it's through energy development, renewable energy development, as well as the job training, any additional educational opportunities that flow from that. So, and that's why we really stand by that reinvestment component. And I think there is a tweak, and that may not have to occur on the Senate side, but really being intentional at how we target and identify disadvantaged communities, using a cumulative impacts methodology, really easy. Oregon Health Authority do it. DEQ has done it. We have environmental health departments that do it. And that's simply overlaying demographics, environmental burden, to really see which communities are burdened most. And I would say, additionally, we want to use census tracts or census blocks as a unit of analysis. Areas, when we say economically distressed areas, is too broad. We really want to be targeting households, communities. We want to make sure it's delivered to those households so that we're seeing improved health benefits, environmental benefits, and economic benefits. And I would additionally expand the climate investment fund opportunities and be very explicit that this includes, you know, weatherization projects. This includes affordable housing that also, when we heard folks from California, right, it's a big contributor to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, particularly if it's located in a high opportunity area. So really targeting projects, and it's provided in my testimony, that both reduce greenhouse gas emissions and achieve equity outcomes and reduce disparities. And the third point, inclusive design and implementation, integral, key, can't emphasize it enough, fundamental component of environmental justice. So that's not just in stakeholder engagement, but that's really sitting on committees related to decision-making, and in particular, those that impact communities of color, low-income communities most, and those with environmental burdens. So that would be a grants committee. That would be rules. So it's extremely important to have that those seats, particularly, again, communities of color and low-income communities have much less access to decision-making structures, to political structures and financial institutions as labor, as business, as environmentalists, as anyone. So it's really important to balance out that power imbalance and ensure that we're having equal access to decision-making. You know, and I just want to close that I really believe climate change poses the greatest threat to economic, social, racial, environmental equity in Oregon and around the world. And that's why the Coalition of Communities of Color supports an equitable carbon pricing policy that really protects households and communities from impacts, reinvests a portion of the revenue to provide economic opportunities, whether it's rural, whether it's urban, supports more resilient communities, including infrastructure that will stand up to climate change impacts, because we are seeing them and we will see more of them, and makes the policy development and implementation more inclusive and accountable. And I really believe that together we can secure a future that with equitable climate solutions, you know, that'll cut climate pollution and transition states off of fossil fuels, close opportunity gaps, and invest in disadvantaged communities, and really create a strong clean energy economy. I think we've already heard that the economic benefits we've seen come out of California and reiterated how many jobs are created in clean energy sector versus fossil fuel industries. We are reinvesting in our communities. We have to change. There's no other option. We're going to be hit with impacts if we don't transition well. It's going to hurt more. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hold questions till the end. If you guys haven't decided, I would say Mr. Bowerman.
Thank you.
Then Hannah, then Mr. Zelenka.
I'm always last.
You don't have to be. If you guys work something out ahead of time, I don't know if you guys
are into it. Exactly.
My name is Tom Bowerman. I live in rural Lane County. I have been asked by a coalition of more than 20 organizations, which somebody earlier in the day handed me a list of, to speak in support of this policy. And I'm pleased to do so. I also speak equally importantly for my family, Oregonians of seven generations. My grandchildren are the seventh generation in my family of pioneers that came in before statehood in here into this state. I own three Oregon businesses and manage 800 acres of Oregon forest land. And I represent those trees because I am very aware of what the science is saying about the risk to that forest. And I saw it this last year, cycle of drought where we're losing fringe areas. I have been studying and analyzing this fairly intensively over the last decade, including participating in in-depth opinion surveying. I am here to say with high confidence that the time to act is now for a comprehensive cap on greenhouse gas emissions. Every delayed year puts us at bigger deficit and greater long-term damage. I mentioned public opinion surveying, and on the OLIS site, I posted four documents, one of which, so I think it's the first one listed, is titled Oregon Public Opinion Summary on this bill. The public is solidly supportive of this type of policy. From the 2013 Oregon Values Project, a survey of over 3,000 Oregonians, we found 72% saying that action is required now on climate change, to 21% saying we can deal with it later. A 2014 DHM research study found a 2-to-1 support requiring businesses selling or producing greenhouse gases to reduce those emissions. And a Policy Interactive 2015 survey, we observed a 70% support over 28% opposition to stronger government policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and an over 2-to-1 level of support for Oregon's legislature adopting a policy like SB 1574. That document that's posted on OLIS has links directly to the surveys. I'm a big believer in being able to go directly to the surveys and judge for yourself how they were conducted. The surveys that we run give full methodology. We subscribe to full transparency and belong to an association that holds me personally responsible for my organization misrepresenting how surveying is done or the results thereof. I can also say that we have support from thousands of Oregon businesses that's available on request, and dozens of agriculturalists obtained in a very short time since the Senate Bill 1574 was officially posted, testament that support is not casual. Most Oregonians are ready for leadership of this type of policy. 1574 is a unique opportunity to, one, get carbon emissions on a declining trajectory. And I agree with you, Oregon has been on a declining trajectory since the recession, but in the last year and a half, the evidence is fairly strong that we've turned back up again. And that's no surprise because of the characteristics of low fuel prices and human behaviors. That has been reported in the Oregon Global Warming Coalition report. You'll see that if you study that. The economic benefits emerge from a fee to emit greenhouse gases on this bill, pollutants to our common atmosphere, coupled with a market mechanism which incentivizes efficiency, emission reductions, and innovations, and in-state investments. Gradually replacing spending our state resources on imported energy and its consequent emissions. Our research evidence suggests that this will quickly yield a net economic benefit over $1 billion per year to Oregon. And I base that citation, and I really appreciate your asking these questions, Senator Olson, on how much it will cost. You'll see in the postings on OLIS, I have how much is it going to cost, and that's based on cited evidence, proportionalizing from what's happening in California, and there's a couple of dozen different reports on that for your observation and entertainment. I commend the two sponsors of this bill for their judgment in forging a public policy into the best chance of passage this session. I also know that the perfect can stand in the way of the possible when achieving policy for diverse interests. I will, however, take this moment to comment on several elements of the bill that many of our coalition members of several dozen organizations hope might be included in the bill. The bill now provides for a 5-year delay of inclusion in transportation emissions in implementation scheduling. We prefer, at most, a 2-year delay. This would enhance meeting the cap and increase emission fees for the transportation sector, fund of about $1.7 billion. We recommend a 5-year periodic update of the emission cap trajectory based upon best available science. This is already kind of inherent in Oregon Global Warming Commission charge of the commission, but we'd like to see this solidified in recognition of the changing aspect of both best science and best practice. And we would like to see implementation to be quicker than 3.5 years as currently scheduled. Senate Bill 1374 offers three complementary aspects: a firm and declining cap on harmful greenhouse gas emissions, an open market mechanism found to incentivize covered emissions lead to the least cost-effective ways to reduce emissions, and a fee-based program to fund transitioning investments from a carbon emission economy to a renewable energy economy. With fuel prices at inflation-adjusted historic lows, there has never been a better time to initiate a policy such as this. So I really urge you to get on with it. I want to make three comments that I've heard discussed and not answered. There was a lot of discussion earlier in the afternoon about credits and their role. Credits are largely being overplayed here. The real elasticity in accomplishment is in the allocations themselves. In California, we observe that it's the businesses that are incentivized and are working on reducing their emissions that market those reductions over to the other entities that are not making their progress. And this becomes an incentive because there's money to be made in implementing these, and that's how they're ahead of Oregon. One could say that California has the lowest emissions per capita in the nation. And so Oregon isn't doing bad. We're doing quite well, in fact. But we aren't on the trajectory to meet the 2007 emission targets that the legislature passed. And those were aspirational rather than hard caps. It was mentioned about the relationship of technology and pricing. And I think that's a very important part to work on. And when prices go up, technology catches up. California set a floor price for their allocations, and they are hugging that floor price of about $13 a ton because innovation and the low-hanging fruit is keeping it there. And there is evidence out there through institutes like the Rocky Mountain Institute that there's a lot more opportunity to reach that goal, but we need to have that incentive there to make it happen. I think that covers what I want to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hannah?
Hi. Thank you so much for having all of us tonight here to give testimony. My name is Hannah Soule. I grew up in Jackson County, and I also work with Rogue Climate. We're a community organization that mainly works in Jackson and Josephine County, working on practical solutions to climate change that result in cleaner energy, jobs, and also a healthy environment. As Deb Evans mentioned earlier, our county is really starting to see the impacts of a changing climate. We're seeing more extended drought, more extended smoke, less snowpack, and it's really starting to impact our quality of life, but it's also really starting to impact our businesses. And as somebody who grew up in Jackson County, I know how important every job is for our rural communities, as I'm sure many members of the committee also know. Just an example is a couple years ago when we had a lot less snowpack, Mount Ashland never opened, and that employs 150 folks in the Rogue Valley on a seasonal basis. And it also shut down many of our tourism industries when we had a lot of smoke in the area. And, you know, we have smoke every couple of years when we have big forest fires, but that's becoming the new norm as our summers get hotter. And as our forests become more susceptible to fires, we're seeing more and more smoke, which is having a really big impact on our tourism industries, which employs a lot of folks in my age bracket, younger generation. So climate change is really important for us to deal with, especially for communities, rural communities. But I'm also here today to talk about jobs because, as many of you I'm sure know, our rural counties really need jobs. And this bill both is an important way to protect jobs that we already have, especially in our natural resource industries, but also to create new jobs in energy efficiency and clean energy. In some of the states where a similar project was already implemented in the northeastern states, they've already seen 16,000 new job years created just through energy efficiency projects and clean energy projects alone, which is a significant amount of jobs to be created in 5 years. In California, they've seen at least half of the country's clean energy investment dollars have come into California as soon as that state made the commitment to start transitioning to clean energy and really prioritizing that. And I think that in Oregon, we could see, you know, not maybe as high as in California, obviously, or maybe not in the northeastern states, but we could see a significant growth in clean energy jobs and energy efficiency jobs. And I think it's important to point out that rural counties are already really leading the way when it comes to transitioning our state to clean energy. Senator Whitsey, your district is a great example. OIT has been an incredible leader in our state in clean energy. Lake County has been an incredible leader. They're going to be one of the first counties in our state to be powered by renewable energy that's produced in their district. So I think our whole state can really look to our rural counties for leadership on clean energy and transitioning to clean energy. And a bill like this is just what we need to kickstart the rest of our state and to support our rural counties in making that transition even faster. Recently, Talent, one of the communities that we work in, participated in a workshop called Making Energy Work for Rural Oregon, and five other communities across the state also participated in this. And in Talent, the community is really trying to develop a clean energy plan, but one of the barriers that we keep coming up against is financing. We need outside investment. We need just a little bit of help to start our communities really transitioning to clean energy and making sure that our businesses on Main Street can stay open, and that folks, young people in our areas and people aren't leaving because of a lack of jobs. And I really see this bill as an opportunity for job creation and also protecting the jobs that we do have in our communities. Today we have a couple of folks from Southern Oregon who made the trip, but we have about 70 more people who are coming tomorrow. And these aren't just folks from Ashland. These are folks from Grants Pass, Medford, Central Point, Phoenix, Talent, Gold Hill, Jacksonville, and Jackson County, who are coming up because this is such an important issue to them. And I think a lot of times folks think that this is an issue that is just people in Eugene or Portland are concerned about. But I think when you actually get out and talk to folks in rural counties, this is a top priority issue. This is both dealing with climate change, helping communities adapt to the changes in our climate that we're starting to see, but also clean energy jobs. So just a couple of weeks ago, with just about a week and a half to let people know about it, we had an info session about this bill in Gold Hill, a small rural community in between Grants Pass and Medford. And over 30 people showed up to learn about this bill, to ask questions and concerns. And they were very excited about the opportunities that this bill provides. And, you know, again, these aren't just your usual suspects. These were school principals, city council members, business owners, few young folks who live in those areas still, who came out to learn about this bill, and many of them have met with their local representatives, and some of them are coming up again tomorrow to really make sure that our rural leaders know that this is an important issue and that they are going to be working with us. Senator Olson, when you brought up, you know, how will this impact local jobs at the facility in Roseburg, I know that this policy can be messy. Like, for example, my boyfriend's brother works at Biomass One, and his best friend works at Mount Ashland and OSF. So, you know, one of the industries could be impacted by this policy, whereas the other industry, if we don't take action on climate change, will also be impacted. So it's messy and it's not easy, and this is a complicated policy, but we really need rural leaders to put aside partisan politics and be at the table to help us figure out solutions. I think that's all I have to say. I guess the last piece I'll say is that I know that China keeps getting brought up, and that we, you know, if China's not going to do anything, we might as well not do anything either. And I just want to give the example that the fact that counties like Lake County and Klamath County have really taken leadership in clean energy has really inspired other communities across Oregon to do the same. And with this policy, we won't be leading. We'll be learning from many other states and provinces that already have policies like this. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can learn from their mistakes and also learn from what has worked well. But we also, by taking action, we can really revitalize and boost our local economies. And this, you know, can really help our struggling economies. But we can also be inspiring other states to take action as well. So when we're talking with folks about the opportunities that clean energy provides, we always share the example of Lake County and Klamath County, because those are counties that are really showing that transitioning to clean energy can create jobs, investing in energy efficiency can keep money in our local economies, and can make sure that businesses can stay afloat and can keep working in our communities. So thank you so much for your time, and I really hope that that our rural counties and our rural leaders can really be engaged in this bill and make sure that it's a success for everybody across the state.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Chair Edwards, and members of the committee. Thank you for having time for us to testify on this very important climate bill. Used to being in this position last. My name is Alan Zelenka with a Z. I'm a Eugene City Councilor, and I'm speaking on behalf of the City of Eugene and the Eugene Water and Electric Board, EWEB. While I am on the Global Warming Commission and recently presented to this committee the Oregon Global Warming Commission's 2015 report to the legislature, I'm not speaking on behalf of the commission. The City of Eugene and EWEB are committed to addressing global climate change and strongly support the passage of and implementation of greenhouse gas emissions reduction legislation. We believe that the best solution to regarding emissions is one that is direct and market-based. Providing a statewide mechanism that reflects both the current climate science and the realities of our economy. Only then can Oregon successfully reach its adopted greenhouse gas emission targets in the most cost-effective manner. Starting back in 2010, Eugene joined a growing list of cities around the world that are addressing climate change and energy challenges by doing local planning with vision and creativity. We built an award-winning climate action program that calls for deep cuts in our community greenhouse gas emissions guided by the actions in our climate and energy action plan. We also adopted the climate recovery ordinance in July 2014 and became the first city in the country to both put our greenhouse gas goals into law and require a plan to meet those goals. Our community recognizes the need to take action immediately and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In a recent community survey, over 75% of Eugene residents agreed that much stronger regulation of greenhouse emissions is needed, and their community voice echoes throughout the rest of the state in support of the Healthy Climate Act. However, we can't achieve our ambitious goals without the state as a partner. Supportive state policies in the area of carbon pricing, transportation investments, clean fuel standards, and others provide an essential and necessary platform for local action. To that end, back in April 2015, the Eugene City Council adopted a resolution in support of statewide carbon pricing. While it may seem that starting with national policy makes the most sense at the federal level, the current political environment in Washington, D.C. is unlikely to develop any national solution soon enough. And time is running short, and we need to take action now. And it's time for states to step up and regions to lead the way. And indeed, they already are. The state of California and the province of British Columbia have already enacted greenhouse gas emission reduction policies, and the state of Washington is considering a carbon pricing policy. So Oregon won't be alone in taking these steps. So while Oregon, with Oregon as a partner, together, the region can cooperatively address the many actions and carbon policy challenges that we need to put in place to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. The 2015 Oregon Global Warming Commission report to the legislature informed us that substantive and fairly quick action will need to be met in order for Oregon, our state, to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. That report had both good news and bad news in it. The good news was that we know what the actions are to meet our goals. The bad news is none of those actions are already in place. The Healthy Climate Act can help alleviate this problem. In the past decade, Oregon has taken many steps towards reducing greenhouse gases. However, these policies seem to typically focus on just one sector at a time or often target greenhouse gas emissions indirectly through either fuel or energy generation standards. And while these policies have proved important in changing the trajectory of our state greenhouse gas emissions, we need the most direct, comprehensive, and efficient approach possible to reliably reach our state greenhouse gas reduction targets, and that being the most cost-effective way to do it would be through a cap-and-trade system. And you have heard similar legislation in California, AB 32, has produced not only significant reductions in greenhouse gases since it was enacted in 2006, but has also made remarkable investments throughout the state in projects and programs that have created jobs, invigorated local economies, while making sure that the less fortunate are not harmed. All the while, California has one of the strongest economies in the country. So the Healthy Climate Act can successfully deliver similar outcomes for Oregon, and we urge you to approve this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you each for your testimony. Questions by committee members?
Yes.
Yes. Sarah Olson. Thank you very much. Let's start and go down the line here. We'll start with Ms. Talmadge. Were you expressing fact or opinion, stating that we have all these different issues going on in your coalition of colors?
It is fact that people of color, particularly African Americans, nationally as well as in Oregon, suffer disproportionate rates of asthma. From conversation with tribal members, I hear stories of less salmon or salmon that's no longer pink and not the, it doesn't have that cultural significance.
So let me stop you right there. That would not be fact then.
Okay.
That would be an opinion.
And
the reason
I think there are less salmon.
I say that is the last few years we've had record salmon runs.
Okay.
So we'll get beyond that.
Okay.
Follow up?
Go
ahead. Thank you. Mr. Bowerman, Policy Interactive, could you explain to me who are the members of your group?
We have three researchers at present. Sometimes it goes up to six.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the director. We have a PhD in social psychology and a master's of social psychology, and they principally are involved in survey research.
Do you have any policy advisors?
We do. We have a number of different categories of policy advisors. I'd have to be working from a list to look at them. We have some lawyers, principally from the University of Oregon. We have some state officials that advise on policy.
Are any of those state officials in this room?
I think maybe Senator Brzezinski is on that list.
Is our governor?
Wait, I'm not a policy.
You should be on that list.
I've sat through like three conference calls in the last 2 months.
He's advising
so
us.
Is our governor a policy advisor?
Yes.
Is Bill Bradbury a policy advisor?
I believe so.
Is Phil Barnhart a policy advisor?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have read your documentation, and I have read your polls. They're very interesting. They are very interesting, except as I see them looking at it from a different perspective, they're very leading, because nothing you say in your poll was said. You've asked several questions like, should companies reduce their carbon output, and everybody says yes. You know, you do that very nicely. But you forget to say, should companies reduce their carbon output, and it's going to cost you $2,000 a year, and you don't get that negative answer out of that. So your polls kind of indicate that, you know, yes, we need to reduce carbon, but what are we as Oregonians willing to pay for that reduction, which is going to be sizable? We've heard the numbers. Some of the numbers, you've thrown out a number of $1 billion. Ms. Cole.
I'm sorry.
You're right. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to get done by it. Oh, it is 7. Go ahead.
You're on
yes,
a
sir.
Roll.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm on a roll.
Next week.
Thank you.
Go ahead,
Senator
Tom, and respond to
and Senator Roll,
the assertion.
First of all, I really appreciate your critique, and we invite critique. How would you like to be a policy advisor to Policy Interactive?
You're a little bit, I don't know that you'd like me on there, because you're a little bit farther over to his side. Then
we have to agree on things to.
Well, no,
for me to take in your.
But from what I've seen of your, your group, it's not really very balanced, and I would love to do it. I guess that would help balance
object.
It out.
If we just try it and see how it goes.
Sure, okay. I'd be glad to do that. Okay, can we move on?
Yes.
Follow up, Ms. Cole. When you had your, you'd mentioned 16,000 jobs in 5 years, and I assume you're talking about the Reggie states. Did you know that most of the utilities out in the Reggie states are really concerned about the fact that they have this cap and trade, but New York, for example, uses this money to balance their budget, and it wasn't intended to be used for, you know, greenhouse gas things? Did you know they were concerned about that?
I wasn't. Each state is a little bit different, and so I'm not totally familiar.
Okay, well, let me do another state that has cap and trade, which is California. Their last report was they generated $2.263 billion from cap and trade. $500 million in 2013 went to balance their budget, which is not the use that this is supposed to be generated for. But let me ask you the question that I need to ask you. You brought those people into a town hall, and you said there was 30 in there. They're all excited. Did you tell them about the prospects of the money that could come into their community?
We did.
Yeah, I wonder why they were excited then.
Your guess is as good as mine. And we also talked about which businesses would be impacted, and we looked at, you know, the list of impacted businesses from DEQ as well.
Did you see that in Douglas? And I assume that, is Douglas County part of yours?
No, we're mainly in Jackson and Josephine County.
Jackson and Josephine County. You know you have a huge list of companies that would be impacted by that? Actually, not huge. There's four. And it looks like it would probably cost them in the vicinity of about $25 million.
The four combined companies?
Yeah.
I think it would be significant. And those companies hopefully would be helped with revenue to help their businesses become more energy efficient and transition to cleaner energy sources. And I think...
Wouldn't it be better if we help those businesses to transition to cleaner energy by allowing them to use their capital to buy new technologies rather than taking their capital away from them and redistributing it around the state? Wouldn't that be better for them? And it would keep jobs in place?
I think we could have an in-depth conversation about that.
Okay. We can do that. One more question.
Great.
Sir, from Eugene. You know, you have eight companies that's got about $73 million impact. Pretty impactful for your communities down there. Could be a cost of a lot of jobs. International Paper is one. How do you respond to them to say that I'm going to come in and you're going to have to pay International Paper, if it's at $60 a ton, $37 million a year? What do you think that business is going to want to do?
The current market price, by the way, is $13 a ton, not $60.
But the Global Warming Commission recommended $60 a ton.
So,
in their own testimony before this committee, recommended $60 a ton. So that's what I based it on. And you said you were on the Global Warming Commission.
Yes, Senator.
Okay.
Senator Olson, it wasn't a recommendation of $60 a ton. It was that's what it would take to meet the goal. With the actions that were already identified in the wedges of the Global Warming Commission's report. So it wasn't a recommendation, it was what it would take. To me, the question is not should we do nothing at zero cost or mitigate at a high cost. Doing nothing actually has a cost. So doing nothing, while we don't know exactly what it is, it's likely to be vastly more expensive to the world and to the local communities than it is to do nothing, than not to act. So we shouldn't decide that it's not cost effective to save ourselves. We should actually act. We should take those steps and be part of the community to move us towards a stable climate. And so taking a more expansive view I think is what required on climate change policy.
Fellow,
sure.
If you don't mind, you know, if you read this bill, I think I've got it right here. Maybe I don't. If you've read this bill, it actually defines climate change. Do you know what it says?
I can't remember off the top.
It's an increase in global temperatures.
Right.
And we haven't increased in global temperatures for 18 years. So are we talking climate change? Or are we talking weather? Weather patterns change all the time. Climate change is something that takes a long, long time. Actually, they talk about centuries to do climate change. So are we talking weather patterns? Because right now, I assume there's a ton of snow on Mount Ashland. And there's a ton of snow on Mount Hood. So we've had a change in weather. So are we talking climate change? And then secondly, wouldn't it be better to help companies through incentives to use their own capital to reduce carbon through technologies rather than to tax them, or I'm sorry, fee them? This is a fee, right?
Yeah.
Are you calling this a fee?
This is a program.
A program. So it's a fee. So rather than fee them, take the money out of their pockets and redistribute it around and then give some of their money back. Wouldn't it be better to help them reduce carbon through the technology process rather than take their capital?
Yes, Senator. So your first question first, and then the second question. The 2015 was the warmest temperature on record. And I think
What was the second one? Which one was
I don't know what the second one was. I think 8 of the last 10 have been in the last
1934.
Yeah, that was a warm year. But most of the majority, I think 8 or 9 out of the 8 out of 10 of warmest years on record have been in the last 12 years or so.
Fact or opinion?
Would you?
Senator, that's a fact.
I'm one up. I'll shut up.
I know you're one.
I'll shut up.
That's a fact, Senator. secondly, I think that's exactly what a cap and trade system does. In California, where I actually do a lot of my work in my professional life, what happens is the industries that are in the cap and trade system are using their capital to make investments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, what they're also doing is reducing their energy consumption by and large because they're reducing direct use of fossil fuel or electricity, which has, in any case, what they're doing is getting a reduction in their operating cost by investing capital to reduce greenhouse gases. So what they're actually doing is investing in their own corporations to reduce greenhouse gases. Ancillary to that is a reduction in energy use, which creates the benefit, which pays for it. And most of those companies are finding that they are doing that on a cost-effective basis, which is also why the price of the auction has dramatically dropped and hovered around $12 or $13. Right now it's about $13.30. It has been there because there are so many opportunities for industries to invest and create those low-cost opportunities. They've never had to tap into the reserve to put up those $40, $50, and $60 auction proceeds that were in reserve to prevent the skyrocketing prices. They've stayed level and low because there's such an abundance of very cost-effective measures to be taken to reduce greenhouse gases, and it's worked. And their economy has been skyrocketing over the last
year. Their offsets come from all across the United States and Canada.
Although, again, offsets are very, very small portion and are limited by law, same as in this law, to 8% of the overall capacity, overall reduction. So it's only 8% of the total. So I believe that it's a good idea to have the offsets come from inside California or inside Oregon. I think it's a good benefit. We're looking in Eugene to have our offsets that we may end up buying come from our local communities, in that being that if we say we've done all these actions and we're still not meeting our target, we need to get the rest from offsets, let's go to our local community and get those projects which reduce their costs, reduce their fuel costs, and put them on a better footing and have it be like a local economic development program.
Sure, what's it? You got a question?
Yeah, I do, actually. For Hannah, I have lived in Southern Oregon for 40 years. I have maintained homes in both Klamath County and Jackson County. I fought fire for the Forest Service for a lot of years before that, before I went to vet school. I actually put myself through vet school 100 years ago, fighting fire in the early 60s in that same area, and as well as across the western United States. Your comments on Klamath and Lake County are, while true, might be a little misleading. There is, to my knowledge, no wind energy in either one of those counties. There is a great deal of geothermal energy. Geothermal energy is a local resource which has been developed, and I hopefully redevelop more. The primary source of energy at Oregon Tech is geothermal. Mm-hmm. The primary source of energy in Lake County is geothermal at Paisley, and also in the city of Klamath Falls, or city of Lakeview, where they don't generate electricity with it, but they use it for space heating and water heating, all that sort of thing. About two-thirds or probably half of original the of Klamath Falls is heated with geothermal heat. So that's where your figures are coming from. And it's not recent. It's been there for a long time. There are, according to the Legislative Revenue Office, there are 9 businesses in Klamath and Lake County at the top end of their estimate. Complying with this would cost them $290 million. How many jobs do you think that would cost compared to what the two or three people it takes to run a geothermal plant?
So the first part of the comment with regards to Klamath and Lake County, when I was talking about Klamath, I was also referring to the programs that OIT has for energy, for renewable energy through their university.
Yes, they're the Oregon Renewable Energy Center have been.
Yeah, so that was great leadership. And in Lake County, they have biomass, and they also have some large-scale solar projects that are about ready to come, that they're starting to work on.
They've had those projects on the books for a long time. I don't know if any of them are producing yet. Yeah, but go ahead.
Right. And then I think with regards to looking at those businesses that would be impacted, I think Alan Zelenka had a great point that there's incentives. The businesses need to start looking for ways to reduce their energy use, to reduce their carbon. And
with respect, yeah. at the price of energy right now, the companies are already doing that. Most of them are already using the technology that's available.
Yeah, I think it'll be a challenge to figure out how to do it. But as Alan Zelenka brought up, the cost of inaction and the cost of not doing anything is not something that we can really deal with right now.
Well, we're already pleased that it's snowing in Ashland. I really don't believe that reducing the global greenhouse gas emissions by 0.04% is going to make it snow in Ashland. But good thing.
I would just like to add, my last perspective here. And this is going to be my last comments of the day, and then we're closing the hearing. Thank you each for testifying. Obviously, this is a contentious issue, and I'm pretty sure that everybody, we're trying to get the details of the bill worked out, heard, a lot of good dissenting opinion, and that is good for public process and good for policymaking. I'm pretty sure that the members of this panel probably are not particularly dissuaded one way or the other about what, I think I know who on the panel is probably against the bill and who is probably for the bill.
Wow.
And that's not going to change. That's probably not going to change this week, and it's probably not going to change next legislative session. Having said that, I appreciate the robust discussion because it gives us an opportunity to dig a little more, and I appreciate my Republican colleagues pushing on me. I think we've uncovered some things that Senator Olson and I need to get on the same page about how people are affected, what businesses are affected. We didn't have a time at the break to do that because my list that I'm operating off of is different than your list. So we just need to get to the bottom of it. And, it's a difficult issue for Oregon. And I'll just share a little perspective of one prominent timber executive and a conversation that I had with him in December. And he said, well, Chris, it's really important for me that I have the lowest cost power possible for my mills. And we were talking about wages, and we were talking about climate policy, and we were talking about all sorts of things. And he said, it's really, really important that we have, we're in a commodity industry, we're price takers, thin margins, et cetera, et cetera. He said, but I also have to tell you that with the price of natural gas being what it is, I'm thinking about shutting down my biomass plant because I can't get the same amount. And he said, and I'm going to have to lay off people in the woods collecting it, some of the thinning programs that we're doing, that the biomass portion on the margin makes a pencil. And then he said the truckers and the people in the plant. And so he said, if I'm looking just at the economics of my business, I want the cheapest inputs possible. But he said, as somebody that cares about the overall economic health of the community, I'm also looking at what that cheap natural gas is going to mean for layoffs if we can't figure out
policies. And so I mean, and just it was a really illustrative conversation because he was struggling with this too, you know. And so we continued to struggle to try to come up with the best thread the needle and the best way to set Oregon on its path to reducing carbon emissions in the way that's most economically beneficial for Oregon and Oregonians, with the lens of environmental justice and taking that into account. And I don't remember the gentleman's name who spoke earlier, but I have always believed that with this particular issue, you are either helping drive a solution and you're part of a solution, and if you're not, by definition, you're part of the problem. And you know, there have been some claims about how clean Oregon's economy is and how clean our power sources are, and they are clean. They're much cleaner than most, which means it'll be a lighter lift for us. I mean, I do not envy being Wyoming or Utah or some of the states that are so much more dependent on coal and have much more greenhouse gas carbon intensive industries. So we'll continue to wrestle with this. We will take the remaining testimony from folks that signed up and didn't get to testify tonight. We'll have that at the hearing tomorrow. We are going to carry over this hearing. Do I need to say we're carrying it over? So we are going to carry over the public hearing on Senate Bill 1574, and we are done for the evening.